Hi, everybody. We are live. So it has been this many days
1 week
since something broke on my Land Rover.
Oh, hooray! It's finally happened.
this car, I mean, I know you bought it used, but it was like how many miles and how many years old was it when you got it?
It was like a year and a half old and something like 15,000 or 20,000 miles, something like that.
Well, it seems like things shouldn't be breaking yet, but anyway, go on.
It's the sunroof.
Oh, know how much I love sunroofs.
Don't tell. Can you not? I will give you infinite money to not talk about this anymore, because the last thing I need is more of the anti-sunroof mafia to have ammunition to be against sunroofs. I love a sunroof.
Me
one
too.
One of the only problems I have with my car is that it does not have a sunroof. I am in a group chat that I'm sure I've brought up many times on this show with a couple of friends of mine who are car nuts, not you two, different friends of mine that are car nuts. And the two of them are parts of the anti-sunroof propaganda machine, and I hate it. So I don't even want to know. Let's move on.
I mean, look, look, the problem is really stupid. It just doesn't, like, yesterday we drove off the island yesterday and, to get some appointments done. And on the way there, I could open the sunroof just fine. On the way home, try to open it. Nothing happens.
That's kind of better than the alternative where it's open and you can't close it.
Right. I thought of that. I told Tiff, I'm like, it's a good thing it's stuck closed and not stuck open. So I got to, I'm sure I have to go get it looked at. Maybe it's going to be a simple, reboot something or fix a fuse. Maybe, probably, I'm sure it's going to involve, oh, this thing died, we have to replace it. It's probably going to be a pain. And this is a minor thing in the grand scheme of things, but, I know there's that YouTube channel, is it TFL? It's like the off-roaders on YouTube. They do pretty good videos. And they got a Defender, and their sunroof died really fast on it, too. So it's something like that. I'm sure it's a thing. But I love a sunroof. And this is one of the great regrets I have is that whatever car I get next almost certainly won't have one, because I really want to go back to electric as soon as I can. And all of the good electric options of, like, either off-road capable things, which is basically just Rivian at this point, or things that are at least like a little bit higher seating position so I can fix my leg sciatic things and keep them fixed. They all are like, oh, we're going to have this big, expansive glass fixed ceiling panel.
And you can thank Tesla for that.
I have had a sunroof on almost every car I've owned for my entire car driving part of my life. I've had one, almost all of them. And I love a sunroof. I use it all the time in the winter. I don't use it at all in the summer because I don't have enough hair. And so, I mostly just keep it closed. Or if I do open it, I have to wear a hat, and that sucks. So, in the summer, I don't use it at all. In the winter, I use it all the time because, it's nice enough out that I want to get like some fresh air blowing in, but if I opened up the side windows, it would be too harsh and like would be too cold on my face or whatever. I know that the days of me having a sunroof are probably limited, and I want to enjoy them while I have them. There goes that.
I don't think they're that limited, because it's like next to impossible. This is why Casey's friends, I'm sure, are complaining. It's next to impossible to find a car that doesn't require you to have a sunroof.
That is why they complain.
EVs that do the stupid glass roof thing. But I don't think they're going anywhere. Like, if anything, the ability to find a car without them is disappearing faster. It's just that in the weird corner of the market that is EVs trying to copy Tesla, they all want to do the stupid panoramic glass thing, which I've never had a car with that. But like, it always seems to me that, I mean, maybe it's cheaper or something. I don't quite understand the motivation. I know it seems cool and everything, but all of them have to do something pretty drastic to prevent the car from becoming a giant boiling fishbowl. So they either like super duper tinted, right?
Or they have heavily tinted usually. So like it's more like you're watching a screen of the sky. You're not really feeling like you're out in the open. Like, now there is one area where it helps a little bit. Yeah, well, there's two areas where it helps. One that doesn't matter to me, which is headroom, which is never
yeah,
something.
And to be clear, that is one of the reasons I dislike sunroofs, because once you put one on a car, I can no longer fit in it without my hair hitting the headliner.
Right, because you have very tall hair. But the other problem.
I wish not anymore. Other...
It happens, man. But yeah, and the other thing is, like, I do like when you have more visibility as the, like, if the windshield goes higher up, and then, like, mm-hmm. you know, if you're, like, stopped, if you're the very first car at a traffic light, sometimes you can't see the traffic light because yeah. your own...
Try being tall. It makes it so much worse.
Right. And so, you know, the sunroofless designs that use more glass oftentimes improve that. But
they put so
that,
much dark tinting, though. Like, right. the ones that have, like, glass, like the Model X, where the windshield basically continues all the way up to the roof, it's so dark tinted, it might as well be, like, a metal beam across there. I don't think you could see a traffic light through the amount of dark they tinted that. The other thing they do in the fancy ones is they have, like, a like the LCD type liquid crystal thing that you can darken it electronically, right? But, like, you can't, the bottom line is you can't just have it clear glass open all the time, because you'll boil in the car and no one wants sun in their face. So there has to be some way to either darken it electronically, or it has to be pretty darn dark all the time. And at that point, like, why bother? It almost makes the 80s version of, like, I don't know what the correct words for this are, but, like, it would have a clear glass pane that slides in and out. Then would also sometimes have a tilted thing that you could slide underneath the clear glass pane to darken it. And then it would have a carpeted thing that you would slide over it that makes it just roof, right? You know what I mean? Inside the car. So you had the choice of, you know, completely open to the outside, clear glass to the outside, tinted glass to the outside, no visibility to the outside. And that is mm-hmm. very passe. They don't make ones like that anymore because it's just, I don't know, 280s. And also the other thing, like, with your, you know, oh, it doesn't open sometimes, and other Land Rover people had problems. This is like the adolescent acne of sunroofs. The real ailment that you'll get, of course, is they will start leaking water into your car eventually. And that's the real joy of the sunroof, is that as your car gets older, if you still own it, eventually the sunroof does not keep the weather out.
Yeah. It's like I'm in that group chat all over again. I'm so happy.
But I love the sunroof. And same. Usually, with this one exception, I've never had a problem with any of them before. I've never had one fail. I've never had one leak. You know, it's just...
But you don't keep a car long enough for them to leak.
Well, that's
yeah,
true.
Well, I mean, you know, the Model S is, at this point, almost 6 years old.
Oh,
five
so
years old,
old,
something
yeah.
like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's I know it's not, like, super old, you know, but, you know, it's younger than your Mac Pro. But still, I don't know. I'm going to miss, when I inevitably get whatever electric thing I go with next, I am going to miss the sunroof. But if it causes me to have to be in repair constantly, maybe I'll miss it less. I don't know.
Yeah, so in summary, a British car has electrical problems. Mm-hmm. You don't say.
I love everything else about it. I'm not super loving, you know, the gas osity of it, but mm-hmm. the lack of electric.
And great mileage driving around a giant rectangle.
Yeah, right.
I'm a little surprised you're not driving to Jersey so they can pump it for you.
Mm. Yeah, because I forgot how.
Yeah, yeah. Jersey's so weird. Anyway, no, I'm sad to hear that your sunroof is broken, and I hope that the repair, whatever it may be, is gentle, easy, and under warranty. And it probably
yeah, it
will be under warranty,
will,
but
yeah.
may not be gentle or easy, so yeah. we'll see what happens.
And still, you know, I have to, like, go do it. You know, that's the biggest pain in the butt. You know, even when you have warranty, that's nice and all, but you still have to, like, schedule the thing, take a day to, like, go get it done. Like, that's, it's all the pain in the butt part of it. That's like, you know, it doesn't just happen for free. It's like whenever people, you know, whenever there's some flaw with an Apple product, and they eventually, very reluctantly, very slowly, after way too long, do some kind of repair program, everyone's like, oh, problem solved. It's like, well, no, it's not. I still have to, like, send it in and go without it for a while and arrange, you know, things around my life to make that happen. And you know, like, it's, you know, just because, you know, a company has a way to service a problem doesn't mean the problem is gone. It just means that, you know, it might cost you less than it otherwise would, you know, yeah, if you had to yeah. either replace the whole thing or pay for the repair yourself. But, you know, it's still an annoying problem that's going to cost you time out of your life.
Yeah, I remember the recent episodes of your Daily Lex, Lex Friedman's podcast. No, not that one, the good one. he was complaining that he had something like repaired under warranty on his car, needed a new part or whatever, and he had to drive it there. He drove it to the dealer three times, and three times he got there and said, oh, we don't have the part. Because after the first time, of course, he would confirm, okay, so you have the part now, right? Because last time I took my car there and I came and you said you didn't have the part. You have the part? No, we totally have the part. Come on in. He comes in, they go, we don't have the part. That happened three times.
And it's a Tesla dealer.
Yeah, well, surprise, yes. It is a Tesla dealer.
I was going to say, I was going to ask, like, oh, wouldn't you switch brands after that? But now I know, oh, yeah, Tesla with some kind of logistical thing where the dealers don't know what they're doing.
Because, like, you never know who you're talking to on the phone or who you're texting to. Like, oh, yeah, no, we totally have the part. Come right in. But that's not the person who's at the dealer staring at the part. Who knows where that person is or what, you know, it's all electronic. Yeah, not fun.
All right. Let's talk about something that is more fun. Let's talk about how wrong you are about audio stuff, Marco. That's fun for me. Samuel Pole writes, Atmos and 7.1 channel sound is often the priority mix for sound mixers today. For a brand new movie, the audio team is taking multi-channel and spatial audio into account first, and then down mixing to everything else. Even a 5.1 system can suffer from loss of detail in down mixing depending what movie you're watching. Since Marco insists on a 2.1 setup, he's losing detail more when he watches a new movie or show than basically anyone.
It's a good thing that never happens, that Marco watches a new movie or show.
Well, so done. Safe.
No, and we got, I mean, we got a lot of feedback on this, and this is basically, this has been John's argument for a long time, that like, that because, especially in particular, because the center channel is so important for things like dialogue and, you know, that I'm apparently missing everything out. But like, first of all, my speakers are not the only situation in which a movie consumer might need a stereo mix. It turns out a lot of people watch movies on tablets, phones, headphones. Like, it turns out many
spatial
people
audio
use
covers
stereo
those.
Mixes.
Because if they have spatial audio on their headphones, which you do if you have an Apple device, then I know it's only two things in your ears. But my understanding is that what you're getting there is not a downmixed process thing. But, you know, the spatial audio track for that thing plays in spatial audio. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is. There is a separate processing step. But anyway, Apple advertises spatial audio for movies, which I hate, by the way. I don't like spatial audio in movies.
Yeah.
But, you know, downmixing is a fact of life. But we're saying that if you have a setup where you're sitting in front of your big TV to watch a fancy movie, which again, Marco doesn't do that often, you know, you are, something in the system is trying to downmix and make sense out of it. It's kind of the opposite of the way it used to be when quote unquote surround sound first came out. All the movies were mastered in stereo, and you had all these weird standards and techniques to take a stereo mix and try to turn it into surround sound.
Yeah.
And they're all so bad because, I mean, what are they going to do? They have to figure out this sound, this portion of this sound, we should make sound like it's more behind you. And it's just all guesswork, right? Whereas now, when we say they're mixed for 5.1, if people think of like a big stew where they're throwing ingredients together and mixing it, no, what we mean is they have soundtracks for every individual speaker. They say, this is the sound that plays on this speaker, and then this sound plays on this speaker, and like individual sounds that play on individual speakers. Obviously, they all come together to make the sound of the soundtrack, but it's not like there's something doling out the sound in little pieces. It's multiple tracks. And so when you have the number of tracks equal to the number of speakers, like if there's a 5.1 mix on your Blu-ray and you have 5.1 speakers, it says, okay, this speaker gets this track, this speaker gets this track, and just doles out straight sound directly to those speakers. And there's much less guesswork than, you know, here's a stereo mix, try to put it out on seven speakers. Good luck.
Yeah. But also like, and I know like, you know, more modern systems like Atmos are even more complicated and actually, you know, are kind of more abstracted in certain ways, but you know, ultimately, a 2.1 setup, if the main way it's going to fail, look, I don't care if stuff doesn't sound like it's coming from behind me. I don't care. But if the main way it fails is in center channel mixing, well, that to me doesn't hold a ton of water because it's really easy to downmix a center channel into stereo. You just send it equally to both channels. It's fine. It's super easy. That's
well,
why,
the complaint
like,
people had about look, that is if you are
our
not
podcast
dead
is generally,
center in the...
I mean, look, most podcasts are generally issued in mono. Does that mean that you have to have a speaker on your forehead to hear most podcasts? No. You hear them in your ears because we just send the same data to both channels, and it's fine.
So for the lack of center channel, the complaint that we got in an email is that if you have stereo speakers and you get the virtual center from the stereo speakers, it sounds great as long as you are sitting in the sweet spot between the speakers. But if you have a bunch of couches and somebody's way on the left or way on the right, the center channel doesn't work for them anymore because they're way closer to the left speaker than the right speaker. Whereas if there was an actual center channel, no matter where they sit, it would sound like the dialogue is coming out of the television, you know, where the people's pictures are, but the mouth's moving, right? It will, you know, if you're way to the left and the TV is to your right, the sound always sounds like it's coming from the TV. Whereas if they're trying to do virtual surround and you're sitting way to the left, it doesn't sound like the sound is coming out of the TV anymore. It sounds like it's coming from like the left speaker more because it is.
I would say if that is a problem for you, you're either sitting way too far off to the side or your speakers have too little spread in their coverage. Like that's not a fault of it being a 2.1 setup. That's just a bad situation in the room or a bad speaker.
No, it is the fault of it being a 2.1 because the sound is not coming from the TV, and the only way to make it sound like it's coming from the TV is for you to be equally distant from the two side speakers, right? I mean, it's not the end of the world. I mean, it's not like,
yeah, there's a lot of like, you know, squish in that argument. Like, you could be like, you know, if there's two people sitting on a couch, well, they can't both be perfectly centered, but you know, you're going to be close enough for at most distances from a TV, you'll be fine, right? Like you know, and if you're sitting all the way off to one side, like, you know, if there's like, you know, couch in the middle and then like, you know, a side chair off to one side, like a lot of living room setups. Well, if you're sitting in that side chair, nothing's going to be positioned correctly for you anyway. You can barely
No, but if you have a center channel, if you're in that side chair, the sound of people talking will still sound like it's coming from the pictures of their faces because the center channel speaker is directly under or over the TV.
Well, anyway, if I haven't lost everybody yet, I might lose you with this, that this might all be somewhat moot because I listen to processed versions of movie sound anyway, because I keep my Apple TV setting on where it has the basically dynamic range compression setting. Let's call it something like reduced loud sounds.
Mm-hmm.
I keep that on all the time on my Apple TV. I watch everything with that setting on because I find the dynamic range of most things to be far too much for my home, you know, where I'm like, you know, we have oftentimes a sleeping child, you know, downstairs while we're trying to watch something, or, you know, I just don't want, you know, I want the volume on the dialogue to be as loud as everything else, because that is what I'm trying to hear, and it's not because I'm missing a stereo mix. It's because, like, you know, I don't want the soundtrack to be boom, ba da ba da, this big loud thing, and then, you know, people are whispering in the middle of it. Hey, what did you hear about this thing that we did? And it's like, oh my god, what? Like, what are you saying? And that's not the fault of the mix. That's the fault of, or rather, that's not the fault of me not having a center channel. That's just the fault of the way things are mastered these days.
Well, if you had a center channel, you could just crank up the center channel. But anyway, all receivers have that same mode of you know, dynamic range compression and stuff like that. That's not an Apple TV exclusive feature. So your stereo speakers aren't the thing that's giving you that. It's just having basic AV equipment.
Right.
I don't know. I was talking to somebody, I don't remember who it was now, that was saying, you know, this person was saying, I am in full support of the principle of John saying, oh, get a receiver and get a bunch of speakers and so on and so forth. But I just don't have space in my life for a receiver in wiring everything and so on and so forth. And I now, Casey, I feel the same way, that I don't argue that John's setup surely sounds better.
You have plenty of room, Casey. That's not why.
No, it's not a lack of room. I just don't want to deal with it. I don't want to wire it. I don't want to deal with it.
I would argue that dealing with your Sonos stuff is pretty close, but
how so? All I have to do is plug it in.
Because they're little
wall.
Computers. They're pretty complicated.
Yeah, but I never have to think about it. You know, here's the thing. There are companies that make things just work. We used to know of one, and then they stopped doing that. I can't remember the name of it. It was like Banana or something. But anyways, but Sonos stuff really does just work, or at least it has so far in the, you know, 3 or 4 months that I've had it. So I take your point, John, but it really was plug it in and then never think about it again.
So this next item here is about this. So this is something that I didn't bring up in the last show. And there's a reason, which we'll get to pretty soon, of why I didn't go this route. But this would actually be an ideal setup for my scenario. So my scenario is, I have a room that is not arranged any sane way that any person would arrange it. So my speakers and my television position and my seating positions are just messed up. Nothing is aligned the way you would want it to be in one of those home theater setup situations. It's challenging, right? And so my sound and everything about it, ergonomically, sound-wise, it's never going to be right. There's nothing I can do about it because it's just the way my house is or whatever. So this system I'm going to describe is the Sony HT-A9 home theater system. Solves that problem in a way that I kind of wish HomePods did. So HomePods, we all like, we talked about it last time. They're radially symmetrical. You just plop it wherever the hell you want in the room. It doesn't matter where you are relative to the HomePod because it has speakers facing in all directions, right? And the subwoofer faces either up or down. I still don't know. And then it has microphones. And it adjusts itself based on where you've placed it when it has accelerometers to know, okay, if it put me in a new position, it will adjust its sound as best it can to make the best of wherever the heck you put it. That's exactly what I need in my weird cattywampus room where everything's on angles. My TV's in the corner and the couch is on the other wall on an angle from it. And there's no way to get things in the right position. So I would love, let's say, 4 HomePods plus a subwoofer without audio delay to plop these little things in the corner in the places where I can fit them in my room, because I can't fit them in any sane position. It's like, well, this is the only place I have for this speaker, and this is the only place. And HomePods are good for that. They're small. I mean, my problem is I don't have power to a lot of the places, which, as I said, is why I kind of appreciate being able to just run speaker wire to my backs, because I don't have a place to plug in a HomePod. But set that aside. Put a smallish thing wherever you can fit them and just say, computers, you figure it out, right? That's another reason that I use the Dirac Live thing on my receiver. I put the little microphone where my head is on my couch, and I say, I know the speaker's in the wrong place, Dirac, but do your best to make it reasonable. And then you put the microphone in 20 other places, and it's not great, right? The Sony HT9 system does that thing. You buy this, you get a bunch of these Sony speakers, which look kind of like tall, bigger HomePods that are less fuzzy. You put them wherever the hell you feel like in your room. You get four of them, which sounds like a weird number. It's like, I get four for a home theater setup? Okay. And you just put the four kind of one in each kind of corner of the room. And then you have to get a subwoofer for this if you want decent sound, because these small speakers have no bass because they're smallish, right? What they come with, kind of like the Sonos, is you come with these four speakers and a little black box that looks like an Apple TV, but bigger, right? And you plug HDMI into that and Ethernet into that. So you don't need a receiver. It's just these four speakers, this Apple TV type box, and then the subwoofer, right? And it just figures it out. It runs a bunch of sound tests. It bounces sound around. All the speakers have microphones in them, and it just figures out how to make surround. And this is the type of thing you would think, oh, that's great for people who are in a compromised situation, but this is always going to sound like garbage, right? And I mostly dismiss these things for two reasons. One, it sounds kind of janky, and it is like, that can't possibly be good. And two, the cost of the system I just described to you is $2,700. You're not saving any money. It's like, what? I'm just going to buy a real receiver and individual speakers once I'm spending that much money, right? But I have to say that I watched one of my preferred audio review channels on YouTube, Andrew Robinson's channel. Am I getting his name right? We'll put a link in the show notes. And he listens to all sorts of the fancy high-end systems that nobody can afford or whatever. And he was mightily impressed by the system. I watched a bunch of others' reviews too. This Sony setup, yes, it costs $2,700, but according to this review, it sounds almost as good as systems that would cost you like $4,000 if you bought them with individual components. And it doesn't make you have to have a receiver, which Casey doesn't want in his life. I already have a receiver, so it's not great for me. But they say that with four things, no center, right? But with four, how does it do it? It's all it's like computational photography for audio. It's all doing what the HomePod is going to do. And he was just absolutely amazed that it can make the sounds sound like they're coming from all directions, including the center and the sides and height things. And, each one of these speaker things has, I don't know if it has speakers, speaker cones facing in all directions, but it's got speakers facing in a bunch of different directions and apparently is incredibly convincing. The other reason I wouldn't find this appealing for me, aside from the price, which is a lot, is that it does what, they call in the video the smile curve, where it super boosts the bass and also boosts the treble, which sounds exciting and dramatic for movies. But even for movies, that's not what I prefer. I prefer something flatter than that. It sounds impressive in showrooms, and it's kind of what people like. And I bet it's what a lot of movie theaters do, because boomy bass and real high treble. But it cuts out the middle of, it makes everything in the middle kind of sound murky. If people like that curve, get this system. Because if you have, it's cheaper. You can't get it into something that sounds better for less money if what you're interested in is watching movies. But if you wanted to play music, you really don't want your music going through an EQ like that, right? I would imagine, even though some people find that quote unquote exciting. I think it
fun,
just sounds
but
wrong.
It's yeah. It usually, typically, if you're boosting the bass and treble that much in processing, usually you're doing it because the speaker's natural responses in those areas are not very good. If you have a really nicely engineered speaker, if it produces enough bass, if it's big enough to produce enough bass, if the tweeter is refined and well designed enough to not have a whole bunch of weird distortion and be able to reproduce really good high frequencies, you don't need those tricks, or you can greatly reduce them. But that's people design things.
And I think these speakers are reasonable quality, but for movies in particular, like what people consider to be exciting movie experience is the bass is very boomy and the highs are very, sparkly. And especially with this system, the whole trick of this system is it will really make it sound like the sound is coming from all around you. Like the immersive or whatever you want to call it, which just we'll get to in a second, the Sonos Proc that has that right in the name. That's what you feel in a movie theater where they have 17 speakers and, the sound is really coming from all around you. And you can watch the review. The person who's reviewing it was saying even with their expensive many, many $1,000 setups, they were hearing things they never heard before in the mixes of movies that they were watching, probably because they're being cranked up artificially by the curve that this thing puts out. The other thing that's bad about the Sony HT9 is that you can't really mess with the audio too much. If you don't like what the Sony thing is doing with it, you have like minor control over how much bass you want. So you could turn down the bass, but you can't really like say, can you give me a more flat response curve and not over boost the treble that much? And not, you know, it's just, you basically just have a bass up and down thing and a couple of different modes, and only one of the modes is any good anyway. But I was impressed that this audio reviewer that I've been watching for a long time was impressed with the Sony thing that seems like it should be garbage, but is actually kind of ideal. If you don't want to deal with a receiver and have a room that is weird and you can't put the speakers in the right places, this thing will figure it out. It makes me wish I could just get that at my house and try it, because I think watching a movie with it would be kind of fun. But I don't know if I'd want to watch like a TV show of people talking with that type of setup, with that type of curve, because that's just too weird. I think I need something more neutral. So anyway, the reason I'm watching this is I've been shopping around for speakers to see if I could upgrade my cruddy speakers to be slightly less cruddy. But as always, my constraint is like, how much space do I have to put these? And I don't want to spend tons and tons of money on it because they're not going to be in the right place anyway. And that's kind of like limiting me, because I look at the speaker, I'm like, oh, this speaker gets good reviews, but that's for a room where the speaker is facing the right direction at the right height. And I can't do that. So I don't know. Maybe I'll end up coming back to the Sony thing. If I did, it would basically have to bypass my receiver, which would be a giant waste of money, but I'm still thinking about it. Anyway, the Sonos Premium Immersive is the link that Casey put in here, which is a similar type thing where you buy this thing from Sonos and it gives you all the things you need for home theater. It gives you a sound bar for the front instead of having a center, rear, and right. And it has the back channels and it has the Sonos Arc subwoofer, which is pretty good.
No, the Sonos Sub Gen 3, the Arc is a sound bar.
Oh, that's right. No, it's just called Sonos Sub. It's the big one, looks like a big Cheerio.
Which is a very good subwoofer, in my opinion. Like, yeah, it's force canceling, and there are almost no home theater force canceling subwoofers that exist on the market. And the one, as far as I know, it's by far the cheapest one.
Yeah, this setup, I would imagine, I've seen reviews of this setup, not on this exact channel, but other things. The Sony one, obviously, it's like, you know, $800 more than this, so it better sound better. But I think it does, just because the speakers themselves, certainly the you know, the speakers are all the same size in the Sony, but all of them are bigger than the bar or the back surrounds in this thing. So they have, you know, bigger cones in them, more speaker drivers in them. And obviously you can get better separation when you can put those four things in the corners of your room instead of having a sound bar right under the TV. So I feel like the Sony thing is the better choice if what you want is movies. But if you want to listen to music, probably the Sonos is better.
Well, and that's the thing, is for us, it was more than just a home theater. And then I think now I'm starting to come back into HomePod territory, but to finish my thought, we do use the home theater, the Sonos Premium Immersive Set or whatever it's called. We do use that to watch TV and to watch movies, but it is probably just as often, if not more often, that it's just playing music ambiently in the house. And where Sonos does extremely well is being able to consistently, and here's a word you don't hear from Apple recently, reliably move sound between speakers and have it playing in different places and so on and so forth. And if I wanted to, I could do this using AirPlay 2, which all the Sonos stuff supports, but I find it's just as easy. And in most cases, I prefer to use the Sonos app to look up whatever it is I want to play and then have it take over. So my phone is none the wiser as to what's going on. It's not serving in any capacity, the playlist that I'm listening to. My phone is completely ignorant of it. And the Sonos is just taking care of everything on its own. And again, adding or removing speakers, these are all things that can be done with HomePods and can be done with AirPlay. I'm not saying it's unique to Sonos, but it works 100% of the time. Every time, which in my experience with AirPlay is not the case. Now, I don't have HomePods. I've never had a HomePod. So
they don't work 100% of the time. Don't worry.
Okay, never mind.
you are not overspeaking here. Trust me.
Okay. Well, I was willing to give the HomePod the benefit of the doubt, but nope. Here, there you go. So, I'm not saying the Sonos stuff is for everyone. All I'm saying is for my needs, I didn't want to have a receiver. I wanted to not have to string wires across the room. I wanted it to be able to play nicely with other speakers because, you know, we effectively have three zones. We have the main living room, we have the porch, and then we also have little portable, it's the Sonos Roam, the littler of their portable speakers. Yeah, exactly. Which, by the way, sounds phenomenal for a speaker of that size. Like, you know, I'm grading on a tremendous curve here, but yes, given how small it is, it sounds very good. Now, in the grand scheme of things, is it a particularly great speaker? Well, not really. But given how small it is, I've been quite surprised how good it sounds to my ears. But that's neither here nor there. The point I'm driving at is, for my setup, the Sonos stuff was really, really nice. But that being said, if I cared more about TV and almost none about music, which is what John was saying a moment ago, I watched that video that we'll link in the show notes by that Andrew, whatever his name is. And if this fella seemed like he knew what he was talking about, I was not familiar with his work at all, seemed like he knew what he was talking about. And again, to reiterate what John said, seemed really impressed by this Sony setup. So if I was in a position that I didn't really care that much about music, which I think is of the three of us, probably more John than anyone, and forgive me if I'm unfairly putting words in your mouth, then I think the Sony setup, again, you know, not worrying about where you're getting power for those rear speakers and whatnot, it does sound damn compelling.
Yeah, the video is even more compelling if you know this guy, because he's not like a high-end audiophile like Magic Gold Cables kind of person, but he does test speakers that cost like as much as a car and everything. So like, he's heard it all. He's not coming from like, oh, I just test consumer electronics and these things sound pretty good to me. Like, he's heard all the good fancy speakers and he has particular tastes, and his wife is also in the videos with her opinion of these things. And the fact that he was impressed by these things at the price, which is not a low price, you know, $27 is not a low price, really shocked me, because most of the time when he reviews stuff like this, he's like, buy real speakers. Like, this is not it, right? So, you know, I came away with a newfound respect for a system that I had previously dismissed. And honestly, at $2,700, I think I would, because my setup does not cost that much, right? I don't think I'd be able to choke down that price unless I was pretty sure I was going to like it. And like I said, I would not buy this. I don't really listen to music, but I don't like that smile type curve, even for movies, and especially not for TV shows that are not movies. Like, I'm sure it makes for an impressive demo. And if you only watch action movies, this is the setup to get for $2,700, because you can't beat it. But I watch things other than action movies. I watch television shows, and I don't want boosted bass and boosted treble in an unadjustable fashion on all the stuff that I watch. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I should just get this and try it in my house. I don't know. If Sony wants to send me a review unit, I will gladly test it out. But Sony is not listening, so that's never going to happen.
All right. So Andy Galletly writes, your HomePod reviews got me thinking about the age of the chip in our Apple TV fourth gen from 2017. Would I notice a difference if I upgrade to a new 4K Apple TV? We don't have a 4K TV and I don't really mind the old remote. Maybe we're missing out on a decent speed bump. I don't know. I don't feel like, for me and the things that I have done with the Apple TV, I don't feel like I've ever longed for processing power. But am I missing the boat? What's the right answer here?
I have usually noticed, with the exception of maybe the very last one, but like when going from the HD family to the 4K family, I did notice a pretty significant upgrade in just general, you know, menu performance, you know, stuff like that. Just like going in and out of stuff, opening apps, you know, going between menus. I did notice a faster performance there. I have noticed less and less of those gains as we've progressed past the initial 4K version. So I think they are still to be had, but you might notice them less.
Yeah. So the thing about these TV boxes, we've said for years that the Apple TV is just overpowered for a thing that watches streaming stuff, because, you know, streaming apps are built into your TVs, and the processors in the TVs are garbage compared to what's been in even like the last 5 years of Apple TVs, because they don't have to be particularly fancy, and Apple's chips are really good. But the reality of any television connected box is you spend most of your time watching video and not interacting with the Apple. Like, you have to go through a bunch of things, navigate, find the thing you want to watch, then you hit play. And then you're just watching it for 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, like however long. Most of your time is spent, like, the performance of that stuff that happened in the hopefully 1 minute to, you know, 2.5 minutes of it doesn't really factor in that much. So that's why it always seems like it's overpowered. Do I need a amazing low power processor to get me to the point where I press one button and then watch something for an hour? No, it's kind of silly, right? That said, there's two things to say. Like, menus being faster is a thing, and I think you will notice it if you upgrade from an HD one to the newest Apple TV 4K. You'll be like, oh, look, the menus are a little bit faster and apps launch faster. Maybe you'll notice that, right? But here's the thing that really kills me with the, you know, because I always get the newest Apple TV. I have the newest one on my TV. Even though that's faster, depending on the app, this is not Apple's fault. It is the fault mostly of the people who make these apps. But depending on the app, they are often so terrible that basic functionality simply does not work and is maddening. Let's give some examples. I want to watch something on a streaming app. You launch the streaming app, setting aside all the stuff I've complained about where you can't even find the thing you were watching before, because that's just like, you know, intentional design to make you see new stuff. Is, you know, see past episodes where we talked about, go to hypercritical.co, reading about it, whatever, right? Setting that aside, you find the thing you want to watch, you hit play, okay? So first of all, very often in major streaming services, there'll be some kind of bug where you hit play and it will just spin for a while and not play anything, and you'll have to like force quit the app and come back and play. Right. And when I say very often, I don't mean like one out of 10 times or whatever, but if that ever happens to someone who grew up with television that always worked, it is incredibly frustrating. You know, Prime Video, I hit play on a show. You're showing me a spinner. Is it ever going to play? Double tap the thing, flick up, force quit the app, the Amazon Prime Video app, relaunch it, hit play. Oh, now it's working. That should never happen. And it does. A fancier Apple HeHe doesn't stop that from happening. Next one. Oh, a little button comes up. It says skip intro. Oh, I've seen this intro many times. I want to hit skip intro. All right. What do I do? Like, the button comes in the lower right part of the screen. It says skip intro. It's a big white button, right? You would think, and this makes me hate the Apple TV remote, all I have to do is press the action button on the Apple TV remote, which on the current one is like the little touchpad-y thing that's inside the thing. Every time I do this, it makes me think, should I go into settings and turn off the touchpad entirely? Because I just want to press that button. I want to press that button so I can do a skip intro. But if you press that button and your thumb moves a little bit when you press it because you're not perfectly up and down, it's like, oh, I think you're swiping. And does some crazy thing that you didn't want it to do. But say I'm successful. I have it on a flat level surface. I come in from above like a robot and I go, okay, I'm going to press the center button. This is not a swipe. I swear, I'm just trying to press. And I press it. The skip intro button, what I wanted to do is start playing the show after the intro. But sometimes it'll freak out and start playing the show in the middle or stop playing the show entirely and show a spinner. Again, that should never happen, but it happens enough for me to like get angry about it. Like, does skip intro not work anymore? All right. Very frequently, like my whole family now, when I go to do skip intro on certain streaming apps, I say, no, don't do it. We know it won't work. Just try to skip past it. Like, don't use skip intro, but skip past it with 30-second skip. How do you do that on the Apple TV remote? Oh, you hit the right side of the circular pad. Click, click. Be careful you don't swipe because that's the jog dial. Be careful you don't touch the touch dial in the middle. Click, click, click. 30-second skip. Up, spinner, blacked out. Now it's not showing anything anymore. Force quit the app. The faster Apple TV doesn't help at all with any of this. It is not a performance problem. They're just plain buggy and crappy and don't work. And, you know, it's... sometimes it's the Hulu app. Sometimes it's the Amazon Prime app. I forget what the other one that I was having complaint about. This like it, I don't even notice half the time which apps I'm watching things on. Especially if you go through the Up Next thing, it uses the Apple Player, which is a little bit different. But anyway, those problems will happen to you on your old Apple TV and on your new one. And no matter how good Apple makes this hardware, it will keep happening until these app makers fix their stupid applications and make them perform the basic functionality correctly. It shouldn't be acceptable that my entire family yells at me not to ever hit skip intro because they know from bitter experience that what that means is another 15 minutes of watching me futz around with the thing to get it to play again. Like literally you have to force quit the app, come back in, go back to your profile, find the program again, find the episode number. It never freaking remembers what episodes we're on, of course, and find the correct episode, hit play on it again. Don't touch skip intro. We'll just sit through the intro because they're so sick of me trying it twice thinking skip intro should work, right? It's not a complicated feature, but it's maddening. Anyway, this is all to say, if you're comfortable with your, you know, fourth gen 2017 Apple TV, there's not much reason for you to upgrade unless you're playing games on your TV. It will be faster. It will be better. Eventually, you should probably upgrade. But most of the frustrations about this product have nothing to do with the performance of the hardware and everything to do with the quality of the software.
Yep. No argument here. And then tell me, John, about the differences between the previous generation Apple TV 4K and the current one, please.
Speaking of hardware, now that I've said that it doesn't matter, it is interesting from an academic perspective to consider what's inside these little Apple TV puck thingies. We've talked in the past about how the Apple TV was kind of expensive, and yes, it was higher performance and everything else, but geez, it's so much money, and these things come built into your television, and you can get like one of those little, you know, streaming sticks for so much less from tons of other companies. Why would anybody ever want an Apple TV? It's not a great buy. The new ones, as we said, came out, and they are cheaper. They made an even cheaper one without Ethernet and without a Thread radio, which is probably not the right one to buy. But still, even the other one is cheaper and doesn't have a fan. So, you know, thumbs up, Apple, you're getting closer to a reasonable price. But this YouTube video that we'll put in the show notes shows what it looks like on the insides of these things. It's comparing the second generation Apple TV 4K, which I think is the one that just got replaced, and then the current generation, the third generation Apple TV 4K. What do they look like on the inside? And when you look in the previous one, the previous Apple TV 4K, you can see how over-engineered it is inside there. Like, it was more expensive, and you can see the money inside it. It wasn't just like, oh, they just charge you because it has higher margins. This thing has like giant solid metal plates sandwiching all the innards, and they have like the little raised metal things around the sets of chips, so they're like RF sealed into these little metal cages because the solid metal sandwich plates, machined metal sandwich plates, clamp the motherboard and press down on the little metal things surrounding each thing, so every set of chips and analog electronics is isolated from the connectors, is isolated from the HDMI and everything. It is so over-engineered. And by the way, this one has the fan underneath it. It is so incredibly over-engineered. It's like, not if you gave someone an unlimited budget, but if you basically said, you have way more money than you need to do this. What can you do with it? It's like, oh, I'm going to machine some metal plates. I'm going to radio isolate these things like nobody's seen. I know you can do this cheaper, but I'm not. I'm going to do it the most expensive way possible. Incredibly over-engineered and actually really cool and fascinating. Then if you look at the current one, it is like a piece of electronics. It's got a motherboard. It's hanging out in there. It's got a little RF shielding made with like a little, you know, metal foil thing that covers stuff up like a sticker with a plastic thing. It looks like every other piece of electronics you've seen. You can see where the money came from. How did they save money on this? It is obvious. Like, this is way cheaper to make. There are no more machined metal plates. The RF shielding is the minimum needed to pass, you know, FCC, whatever things. The person who was measuring it says, hey, on the new one, you can see like the signal from the various chips and power supply showing up on the HDMI output. It doesn't mean that it's bad or broken or wrong or incorrect or it's not going to work. It is within spec of, you know, what is required to send an HDMI signal and to pass all of the RF shielding stuff. Like, it's fine, but it is not over-engineered like the other one used to be. So you wanted an Apple TV that costs less money, you got one that is cheaper in both senses of the word.
And then Christopher Sardinia brings to our attention by writing, in episode 520, you discussed an iCloud Photos backup solution. It worked great. On that topic, I built an open source tool to do something similar for iMessage. Now, this came across my transom at some point in the last few weeks. I haven't had a chance to play with it myself, but this looks really, really slick at a glance. Have either of you had a chance to play with this?
I was trying to think of why I would want to export my messages, aside from like not trusting Apple to keep them safe and someday they get corrupted and I wanted to save them because it's like an archive of fun stuff. And this is an area where another area involving online stuff where Google stomps all over Apple, because Google makes it so easy to get any of your data out of Google in a reasonable-ish format whenever you want. They even make it so you can schedule it to come to do exports on a regular interval. They have different, like if you go to, what is it, takeout.google.com, Google Takeout is the branded name for it. You can get everything you want out of Google. And that's what we've talked about in the past. I export my Gmail on a regular basis just in case, you know, my Google account ever dies or I lose everything. I will have all my email messages, you know, and the stuff that's in Gmail, half of that is stuff that I imported into Gmail when I signed up for it. So I've got email and Gmail going back to the 90s. But Apple, it's not so great in that. The Notes application, I would love to export that to backup. There's a bunch of apps we've talked about on the show of like, here's how you can export your notes. Why is that not built in Apple? Like, why is there not a way for every Apple repository of data for me to export it somewhere else offline to have my own copy of it? The Apple way is you should never have to worry about that. That's a techie concern. Don't worry your little head about it. We'll take care of your data. Exporting stuff like that is a techie thing that we think people should not have to worry about. But we all know, some of us from bitter experience, it is a thing you kind of have to worry about. So if you're paranoid and you really, really want to preserve all those messages, Apple doesn't help you there. You've got your iCloud backup where in theory everything is stored, but if something goes wrong, it gets corrupted, or you lose your Apple ID, or like there's so many things that can go wrong where the Apple copy of your data is inaccessible. So if you really want those messages, you need some way to export it, and Apple is not forthcoming with a way. So all these people make these things that just use the official API to get your data out and put it in some format. I haven't used it because I don't consider my messages to be particularly precious. I don't do that much text messaging. They're kind of ephemeral to me. But if you feel differently, you can try this out.
Yeah, I haven't tried it either, but if I had a need for this kind of thing, I absolutely would. But yeah, I'm mostly with John. Like, I wish these formats were easily exportable and importable back into their apps. I wish there were some like better, more usable file system representation of them so that they could take part easily in other backup formats and other file management schemes that we might need some time or want to use. But that's not the world we live in right now, unfortunately, with these things.
I vaguely do you remember, didn't ADM have like an HTML-based format where you could like export your conversations and it would show like little I think maybe it used HTML tables or something, or maybe it was CSS, but it would show like little speech bubbles, but that was all HTML. Like the speech bubbles were HTML. It was so overwrought and silly, but you could open these HTML files and you'd be like, oh, this is just like a big, long scrolling thing that looks just like my conversation did in ADM. Those days are long gone.
Yeah, and that was even, I mean, I think even iChat might have done that, because like, and it wasn't something you had to choose to do. You could just find those files on disk. Like they were just in a folder somewhere under library, and you could just find them and copy them and read them and do whatever you wanted with them. And now everything is more complicated, and it's based on, you know, databases, and it's based on cloud syncing stuff, and
you know, it's encrypted and all the, you know, a vast improvement over having all your messages in plain text in like a library application support folder on your Mac.
Yeah.
All right. I think we are good with follow-up. We had some breaking news a week ago or so. So I guess it's not really breaking anymore, is it? Anyway,
broken news.
broken news. Some broken news. The plate was broken. Apple, this is on Mac Rumors, Apple dropping product design chief role, team to report to Chief Operating Officer Jeff Williams. Reading from the article, Apple does not plan to name a replacement for Vice President of Industrial Design Evans Hanke when she departs the company in the coming months, according to Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. Instead, the report claims that Apple's product design team will report directly to the company's operations chief, Jeff Williams. So there is no longer a king or queen of the design group. They are all mere serfs to Jeff Williams.
Yeah, I don't know how... You know, it's always very difficult to try to analyze Apple executive and higher up staff shakeups like this, because we don't really have a good idea from the outside of the details of what everybody does. You know, we have kind of this, you know, the public version of this, which is incomplete, oftentimes wrong, but at least, you know, very incomplete. And so we don't really know what's going on here. We you know, big things that we don't know really are, you know, how, first of all, I think I'm upset about this, because since Evans Hanke took over, I've been very satisfied with the better balance of functionality versus good design that Apple's products have had. And
HomePod
that goes
accepted.
Right. Yeah. Like, you know, so, and that, you know, that goes right to, I'm sure, at least part of Evans Hanke's work. So, I'm kind of upset to lose her, but you know, when we look at what they're doing here, there's two big unknowns to me, which is how good was everyone else who was directly under her, who is now just going to have one less level of management between them, because I think she reported to Jeff Williams before, I think, so this is just going to, you know, take away one level of that management. So big unknown number one is, what do all those next level people, like, how good are they? And how much of the work was theirs versus hers, et cetera. And then the second question, which I think is one of the biggest unknowns to the outside world at least, is what the heck is Jeff Williams about? What is he good at? What is his personality? What kind of product sensibility does he have? I don't think any of us really know from the outside. He shows himself like a brick wall of drab boringness to the rest of the world. So, you know, we can't really tell, does he have good product sense? I mean, first of all, I hope so, because Tim Cook keeps giving him more product responsibilities, and he's clearly, as we've mentioned before, the Tim Cook hot spare. So he's clearly, you know, like the next CEO in line, unless something major changes. So I wish I knew more about Jeff Williams. I wish I had a better idea of the kind of things he has, the kind of things he's good at, the kind of things he's not good at. You know, we have some of that visibility with Tim Cook, but Jeff Williams has been placed in a lot of in quite a significant role in leading product development, and I don't think we know enough about whether that's a good thing or not.
Yeah, Evan Sankey was the replacement for Johnny Ive, right?
Yes.
More or less on the hardware
pretty much, yeah.
Side,
not,
only?
Not quite in title, but I think in role, I think yes.
Yeah, but on the hardware only, right? Because
yes, yeah, software is still our wonderful friend Alan. Yeah.
So here's the thing with this change, right? And I don't know the details of this as well, but a couple things. With people high up in a company like this, it's very easy to fall into the trap of having figureheads for things, right? From the outside, you have to do it. It's basically from a PR perspective. You need a human face that represents a larger whole. So very often people like Johnny Ive or the head of any department or a big vice president, they become the face of whatever it is. And, you know, people will, the backlash against them will be like, well, that person doesn't do everything. They're just the public face of it. They're just the figurehead. Right. And, in many respects, of course, that's true. They can't, you know, they, once you reach that level, you're no longer actually doing the work really anymore. You have people under you who are doing the work. And sometimes you have people under you and the people under them who are doing the actual work. That's hierarchy, but you need someone to be the face of that department. And in many respects, Johnny Ive was the face of that, you know, the whole industrial design group and eventually all of user interface at Apple long after he had stopped, you know, individually designing any particular thing himself, right? But the flip side of that is, even if you never literally design anything, like if you never come up with an idea, you never make, you know, you just don't design anything, you as the head of Apple's hardware design can have and almost inevitably will have a tremendous influence over what happens beneath you, simply because in any company, you're always trying to sort of please the boss to get a good promotion, to do well in your job. It's how one of the ways you measure your progress. And if you know your boss has a particular taste, like Johnny Ive doesn't like a lot of ports or buttons and like simplicity, you know, don't come up with a design that your boss isn't going to like. And even if the boss never does anything, once you show it to them, you present it to the wider group or you have a review with them or whatever, they're going to have opinions on it. They're going to say, even if it's just, I like that, I don't like that, thumbs up, thumbs down, it's going to influence what everybody does underneath them, because it's impossible, especially in a field of opinionated design, not to know what does Evan Sankey like and what does Evan Sankey not like? What does Johnny like and what does Johnny not like? And without lifting a pen, without designing a single thing, without drawing a single curve, without even coming up with any ideas of like, I think the next iPhone should look like an Oreo cookie, without even that level of high level stuff where you just say that and leave for 2 months and come back and expect the iPhone 4 to be there, right? And not that I'm saying that's what Johnny Ive did at that point. I think he was much more involved then. But like, what I'm saying is, even though you don't do any work, who's in charge has a tremendous influence. That's why I think this change, and I don't know anything about Evan Sankey and whether I liked what she's done or not or whatever, but I think changes like this can potentially be a good kick in the pants, because no longer having a single person as the head of all of this frees up all the people who used to report to Evan Sankey to come up with designs that Evan Sankey might not have liked, but that are still good. The wild card here is what Marco was saying. Okay, but is Jeff Williams the type of person who's going to swoop in and be like, I'm the new Evan Sankey and I'm going to give thumbs up and thumbs down? Or what I think probably more likely is Jeff Williams kind of like Tim Cook and kind of knows this is not my strength. I'm not an industrial designer. So I should mostly take a hands-off attitude and more or less trust the people who report to me in the design department that they know what they're doing. So when they come and present to Jeff Williams, if they ever even do that, here's the designer of the new Apple, whatever, as long as he doesn't viscerally hate it, as long as they make a convincing argument, he doesn't have as many, not preconceived notions, but he doesn't have like the taste that a designer like Evan Sankey would have to say, I would prefer it be like this. And I'm not saying the boss always imposes their taste on all their subordinates and just makes everything a monoculture like that. No good boss does that. But inevitably, that is a factor. And so my feeling is that Jeff Williams is going to have way less a strong design opinions than Evan Sankey, because he's not literally not a designer, right? No matter what product opinions he has, hoping that he will realize these are not his strengths and be more hands off. And what that will allow to happen is people with good ideas who previously could, you know, people with good ideas that couldn't get past Johnny and maybe still couldn't get past Evans, if they can just make a convincing case to Jeff Williams that it's a good idea, then that will give us new products that we previously couldn't get. Now, that's not sustainable long term. It is good to have someone who's in charge of the whole department and have that person sort of be an actual designer who, you know, and not Jeff Williams, not the COO, right? I'm not in favor of the org chart where your industrial design group has five people who report to the COO. That's not great. But this little break here until someone rises from the ranks to become the new Evans Hanke, or until they hire someone from the outside or whatever, I think this is an opportunity for us to get designs that we wouldn't otherwise see. Because I still feel like there are designers inside Apple who would like to make products that are better in the ways that we complain about on all these shows. I mean, an example of like, hey, if you put ports on your laptops, people will like them. We had to scream that for like 8 years before personnel changes essentially allowed that to happen, right? Maybe that's also true of the HomePod, or, you know, we were just talking about that Sony setup with all the different speakers. HomePod could be that product if the people designing it wanted it to go in that direction and weren't obsessed with, oh, it just has to have one power cord and it can't be a piece of AV equipment and it has to be, you know, standalone software powered Siri, whatever, blah, blah. Like, that some of that is product design and, you know, what product are we making? Not how is that product designed, but that is all kind of combined together to some degree. So what I'm hoping is that we will see what I hope is a not too long break, maybe a few years here, we will see some new and more interesting designs be able to come out of the second tier of designers, because I know there's got to be good ideas in there that we're definitely not getting past Johnny and maybe not even getting past Evans. So I am mostly not upset about this. Of course, the caveat there is, but I don't have any idea what's going on in the company. Maybe Evans Hanke was the best designer they had, and now all they have are a bunch of people who are not as confident in their abilities. And the next time they're asked to do something big, they're going to be put in a situation where they're over their heads and they would benefit from having someone more experienced like Evans Hanke to sort of guide the ship. That can definitely happen too, but I literally couldn't name a single person other than Johnny Evans Hanke in the industrial design group. So I have no idea what the second level, third level, or fourth level of that staff looks like. I just hope it's a bunch of good people.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that gives me pause about this is, what are the political implications of it? You know, because like you were saying a minute ago, if I'm one of 20 or whatever designers and I want to be the new king, I'm going to do, maybe not, you know, maybe I'm not going to stab people in the back because I'm not a jerk, but I'm going to do whatever I can to be the star to Jeff and look like, oh, I'm the one that's indispensable. I'm the one with all the clever ideas. And that can create, that can be used for good or evil, right? Like, it can be used to really try to get some incredible work out of this group of 20, let's say. But it can also be kind of a poison pill, and it can really sour, you know, these relationships that, from everything we've read, at least when Johnny was still around, allegedly these designers were all super duper tight with each other. And I don't know, I worry a little bit that it's going to get a little bit figuratively violent as, you know, the situation tries to figure out who's going to be the new king or queen. And I don't know, I like Marco, I think, had said originally, it's hard for us to know from the outside what the political sphere and what really day-to-day looks like on the inside, especially with industrial design, which seems to be one of the most tight-lipped groups within Apple as it is. So it's tough for me to say. I don't think I love this. I think maybe I'm too traditional, and I like having one, you know, directly responsible individual, to use an Appleism, one DRI in charge of everything. And I don't love the idea of Jeff Williams having to split his time. I mean, just look at, I mean, John, you're the only one who's been a people manager amongst the three of us, but having, you know, 10 or 20 direct reports when you're anyone is not easy, from what I understand. And when you're already as busy as the chief operating officer of one of the biggest, most profitable companies in the world, I can't imagine he has an overabundance of free time to be doing, you know, day-to-day people management sort of things. So I don't know. I don't love this, but I don't think it's necessarily a problem right now. I think it would give me a lot of worry if it remained this way in a year or two. But we'll
that's why I have to think that CEO is just a placeholder, because this happens a lot in org charts. If someone important leaves and they're having trouble replacing them, there's a placeholder person who for a while has too many direct reports. And that's why I have to imagine that Jeff Williams is going to be necessarily more hands-off, because he just doesn't have, forget about the expertise, he doesn't have the time to be dealing with. I don't know how many new reports he's getting, but his fan out is probably not appropriately balanced at this point, and so they're probably going to rebalance it. They could rebalance it by putting two or three lieutenants in charge, and maybe that, for all we know, again, we don't know what the org chart, for all we know, he only has two or three lieutenants, and it's not even that bad, right? But, you know, if he has an extra 10 people reporting to him, that's too many, and so they're going to want the fan out to be one or two or three. In terms of the infighting thing, I have to feel like the Evans Hanke and Johnny Ive job is exactly the type of job that no designers want. Like when you reach that level, especially in a company like Apple, it takes a certain kind of person to actually want that job. More often it's like, I'd rather just be a designer. I mean, part of it becomes the glory of like, and now you're the figurehead. And now when the new Apple, you know, car comes out and everybody loves it, you can say that was my thing. I'm the head of design. And let me talk about the design in the video, you know, like there is some glory that comes with that. But boy, it's just like so much. It's so difficult to operate at that level of a company. So much politics is involved, so much complexity in terms of, you know, how do I tell whether I'm doing a good job or not? If there are products that succeed or fail in the market, how much of that is attributable to design? In many ways, Johnny Ive was protected by his accomplishments. I'm the iPod, iMac, you know, you may have heard of my work. I'm kind of well known. I did a pretty good job. These products are pretty successful. And that protected him for a long time, probably too long, from taking, you know, his fair share of the blame for products that didn't succeed as well in the market because he's Johnny freaking Ive. Evans Hanke did not have that much protection, but I think made better products towards the end there than Johnny, which is great. But a new person, like, who wants to raise their hand and say, I'll be the person who takes all the blame, even though I have very little to do with the products that come out just because I'm the head of the design and they come out with a stinker product. Like, you know, how even like the HomePod, which I was just saying, that's an example of older thinking. Maybe Evans Hanke had nothing to do with that. And that design was already in the can before she took over. Right. That happens. You know, products come out later than you expect or whatever. But if everyone hated the new HomePod or something, we'd blame her because she's the head, right? Or she would be the face of that product. And, you know, the same way we would be like, oh, the Johnny Ive design, despite the fact, again, that it's not him designing it. He was probably coming in for a meeting once a month towards the end there, right? But he was the face and he was the name. And when we complained about something about an Apple product and it had to do with hardware design, his name would be in our mouths, right? Who wants that? It's a tough, you know, gig. In my experience in big companies, I've seen more times than I can count, not just myself, but other people, like where there's a position like, oh, who wants to be to go up to the next level to be, you know, whatever, the senior, whatever, who wants to go to the VP level? And you would see all the best people, the people who are the best at the jobs that they had, they did not want to become a vice president of whatever they're doing because they wanted to continue to do their job. Sometimes they get frustrated and be like, oh, this vice president's a jerk. If I need to be in charge so I can stop people from being a jerk. And sometimes they would get that job and say, I hate being a vice president. Like, it is so different. It's so different to be that high in such a big company than it is to do the actual work. Even just one level below, still, you can kind of define your own job and do the work. But once you're at the Johnny Ive level, you can't be there like machining stuff and sketching things. If you are, your boss is going to tell you you're not using your time appropriately. That's not what we're paying you for anymore, right? It's a different set of skills. You need to lead this entire organization. And leading them doesn't just mean looking at what they do and giving thumbs up and thumbs down. That's not leadership, right? You need to lead them. And it's like, how do I do that? I'm a designer. That's why people don't want that job. And why is Evans Hanke leaving? Maybe because she's got enough money and wants to do different things or whatever. Who knows? That's always at the top level of a company like Apple. That's always the thing I'm thinking is, oh, someone left who was a senior executive at Apple for a while. They probably don't have to work anymore. I mean, not that I'm, you know, counting other people's money, but like if you're a long tenured Apple employee or even if you're not long tenured, these jobs pay a lot of money. And, you know, setting aside RSUs or whatever people are getting, you know, they make a lot of money when you work for Apple and you like report to somebody who reports to Tim Cook. That's a good salary, right? Setting aside all the other benefits you get. So when someone's leaving, I'm like, good for them. Like, who says you have to be, you know, from all the things we've heard, working inside Apple is a tough gig. It's a high pressure situation. A lot of eyes are on you. People work hard. They work long hours. If someone wants to take a job that is less stressful or just not work anymore after putting in many years at Apple, I say good for them. You know, and I don't read anything into it like they've lost faith in Apple or are leaving or they got kicked out of the company or whatever, even though that happens occasionally. But in this case, you know, like I said, I'm looking forward to a, like, you know, when the cat's away, the mice will play for a little while until they can fix their org chart and somehow get things back into a normal shape.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. All right. Do you need me for this next part or should I just take a nap? There's a report. Apple is unlikely to launch a new Mac Studio as it instead focuses on the Mac Pro. That means that hypothetically the Mac Studio might be one and done, just like the iMac Pro, which makes me sad because I really dig the the idea of the Mac Studio, even though I don't have one. But anyway, this is reported on 9to5Mac. They're quoting Mark Gurman, who wrote, "I wouldn't anticipate the introduction of a Mac Studio in the near future. The upcoming Mac Pro is very similar in functionality to the Mac Studio and adds the M2 Ultra chip rather than the M1 Ultra. So it wouldn't make sense for Apple to offer an M2 Ultra Mac Studio and an M2 Ultra Mac Pro at the same time. It's more likely that Apple either never updates the Mac Studio or holds off until the M3 or M4 generation. At that point, the company may be able to better differentiate the Mac Studio from the Mac Pro."
Yeah, I don't know what to think about this yet, because, you know, it's hard to really say, you know, whether the Mac Studio needs to continue to exist before we know pretty much anything about the Mac Pro. You know, it is very possible that this product was basically just a bridge product to get to the Mac Pro age, which, you know, wasn't ready yet. But I don't know. It seems, I mean, look, the iMac Pro seemed like it fit a pretty good slot too. This seems like it fits a pretty good slot in the lineup, but the only thing that I think would make this report make more sense is if you also take into account Gurman's previous reporting that basically the really big processor Mac Pro was canceled or delayed more. And so maybe Apple's original plan was that the Mac Pro would be able to have a higher ceiling or have more capabilities than what they're going to end up being able to ship with it. And so maybe when they originally, you know, were you know, designing this lineup and planning it all out, maybe the Mac Studio made sense as a permanent member of the lineup because the Mac Pro was going to be even higher above it. And then as they were developing the Mac Pro, maybe they realized or decided it's not worth going that high, or we can't easily go that high, or there's some major downsides or whatever. And so then once the Mac Pro is released closer to what the Mac Studio does and capabilities, then I could see the Mac Studio not being as necessary anymore. It's also possible Mark Gurman's info is just wrong. And that's, you know, like whenever we get rumors like this, you know, there's definitely some confirmation bias or whatever it is. Like when like you remember all the correct things that the psychic says and you disregard all the incorrect things. You know, when you look back in retrospect at what the rumor mill predicts versus what actually comes out or what actually happens, oftentimes there's pretty large mismatches there. So it's really hard to tell, but I think if the Mac Pro ends up being fairly accessible at its low end, and that's a pretty big if, I think, but again, we don't know anything about this product yet. So if the Mac Pro basically ends up being a Mac Studio in a larger case with card slots, well, that's not going to be that different. It will be substantially larger, probably, and it will be somewhat more expensive, but the Mac Studio is already pretty expensive. So without seeing the Mac Pro, though, it's really hard to know whether the Mac Studio will be necessary anymore once the Pro comes out.
Kind of reminded of the iPad Pros that recently got updated, but not really updated, and all the gnashing of teeth about that and the various people from inside Apple, you know, conveying what it's like, kind of gave a lot of support to the theory that it just takes a lot of money to revise hardware products, and there wasn't enough time, money, and resources, not just money, but like time, money, resources, people, like all the things that would go into making an all new iPad Pro. It just wasn't in the cards for it to happen this year, so soon after they were previously revised. And that gets into what I think is the kernel of truth in this rumor, guess, speculation, or whatever, is that the amount of resources Apple is going to put into a product line are proportional to how many they sell and how much money they make. And once you get into desktop Macs, as this article that we'll link in the show notes from Jason Sell reiterates, you're a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. The Mac is like less than Apple gets in services. I think of the Mac as like less than the iPad, or maybe it's close to it. Like, you're already in a fraction of the pie. And then like 75% of those are laptops. So now you're into a fraction of that fraction. And then of the desktops, how many people are getting the Mac Studio? It's so few machines, right? And it doesn't mean they shouldn't make them. But what it does mean is when it comes time to allocate resources, whether that be people, time, or money, does Apple want to allocate the resources to update the Mac Studio every single year like they do the MacBook Pros, or like we think they should in the MacBook Pros? No, it doesn't really. Like, if you have to prioritize, you're going to put that money into the new line of MacBook Pros, right? or the new line of 24-inch iMacs, for that matter, the ones that they sell more of, that are more popular products that fill more people's needs. So the idea that the Mac Studio would skip the M2 and come out with the M3 makes perfect sense to me, not because that's what I prefer to happen, or not because Apple couldn't put an M2 in it, but just because when they're allocating the resources to do that, whether it's manufacturing resources, design resources, or just plain money to, you know, make an all new design. Because again, when you make the all new design, it takes a while for that to become cheaper to manufacture. It takes a while for you to, like, you know, get all the kinks worked out of it or whatever. You can't, like, it's more difficult to do that for a narrow interest computer like the Mac Studio. So yeah, if it skips the M2 and goes to the M3, I think that will be reasonable. Obviously, the most extreme case of that is the Mac Pro, which it seems like, and again, this is the article linked from Jason Snell on Mac. No, it's $6, or is it a Macworld article? Just linked.
I thought it was Macworld.
Anyway, his title is Apple Making a Mac Pro Nobody Wants? And he sort of goes through the recent history of the Mac Pro, which is, there's a big problem with the Mac Pro, but don't worry, Apple's going to fix it. Wait a long time, wait a long time, wait a long time. Yay, Apple fixed it. There's a big problem with the Mac Pro, but don't worry, Apple says they're going to fix it. Wait a long time, wait a... Like, the gap between the updates to the Mac Pro is huge. And it is, that gap is proportional to how few people are buying Mac Pros. Back in the heyday of the Mac Pro, or the Power Mac G5, way more people were buying that computer because the laptops couldn't touch it in performance. All of the quote-unquote pros, anyone who uses Xcode all day, anybody who does anything remotely strenuous with their computer back in the day, you had to get a desktop if you wanted decent performance because the laptops could not come close to the performance of the desktops. And so if you looked at that, what does the Mac sales pie wedge look like back at the time of the Power Mac G5? It was still mostly laptops, probably, or becoming mostly laptops, but it's nothing like it is today. And there was a perceivable difference. All the people who wanted the best performance got desktops. That's not true anymore. And so the number of people who need the biggest computer that Apple makes has got to be so small. And then to top it off, Apple tends to invest huge amounts of money in the Mac Pro, even the trash can. No other computer they made look like that. It was totally different from manufacturing technique to construction to shape. Like, everything about it was like, this is not a warmed over existing desktop Mac. It is a totally new thing, right? And that turned out not to be a great design. But look at the original cheese grater. The Power Mac G5 was it the first one that came out with that case, I think?
Yes.
It looked like a big heat exchanger, right? They made that case and they put the money into manufacture the case and they used that case for years. It survived a processor transition. Why? Because it cost so much money to design and manufacture that case. And yeah, they changed it. So like the fans, all the insides were different and the fan holes in the back were different and where the ports were different.
Yeah, I was going to say, the Mac Pro, like the Intel version was like radically different inside than the PowerPC version.
Yeah, and even within Intel, if you just look at the back of the machines, you can identify them like, where are the fans? How big are the fans? How are they positioned? The ports in the front were, but in general, they didn't say clean sheet, we're making a new tower computer. They're like, we put the money into this thing, we're going to ride this tower design, because they got to, they had to make their money back. We're not selling that many of these things, eventually selling fewer and fewer. When we're allocating resources, we can't say, okay, design team, you get to design an all new Mac Pro because it's a new year. It's like, no, you get to take the existing Mac Pro and give it a facelift. And even if all the insides have to change, we're still not giving you the time of resources to design an entirely new external case. This happened again when the 2019 Mac Pro came out. We talked about when we first saw this machine, we said, look at this case. This is a complicated, weird, fancy. It's the fanciest Mac Pro case I think they've ever made. In terms of how much does this stupid piece of weird, machined out aluminum cost to make versus the tube versus the cheese grater, this has got to be the most expensive, most complicated case they've ever made. This is not a one-off.
I think if you include unnecessary internal complexity, I think you have a hard sell between the liquid cool G5 and the trash
that liquid
can.
Cooling was farmed out and it was not very good. But I'm saying the case, just like the actual physical shell case thing. This case, it has to be the most expensive. It's certainly the most machining steps. It's the most complicated, So they made this computer. They're not going to make a new full size tower case, I don't think. If they do, I will just fall off my chair because. We said when this thing came out, this is going to be the case design for full-size tower computers from Apple until they stop making them or until many years pass, right? Because that's just the way they do things, especially since it's such an expensive case, right? So this gets into the Mac Studio question. If it is a tower computer, this is the case they're going to use because this is the one they have. Like they can't justify the resources to redesign the iPad Pro, which sells way more copies than the Mac Pro. There is no way a 2019 full-size tower is going to be followed by a 2024 full-size tower that is all new. That's just not going to happen. If it's a full-size tower, this is the case. Although I think it would be cool if they made it like Space Garrett black or whatever. And yeah, you can move the ports and yeah, you can tweak it or whatever, but this is the case, right? But maybe they don't make a full-size tower. Maybe it's just a bigger Mac Studio, right? And this gets to what Jason was talking about, and we've talked about many, many times in the past. If it's just a Mac Studio with slots, like that's, as they said in the movie Contact, it seems like an awful waste of space. Like, can you take the guts of a Mac Studio, put it inside this massive case, and it's like hiding in the corner, basically. And then you have slots, I guess, on a giant motherboard that you're going to put what in? And that's that question about the GPUs. We don't want to rehash all that, right? It's weird and mysterious. If the high-end one is canceled, but the four things, because that you'd need the cooling for that in here, and it's really just an M2 Ultra, but with slots, I don't understand, like, what the case is too big. It's like the M1 Mac Mini was, where it looks like the insides are too small for the case you're putting them in. And I mean, so if that's the case, there's still room for the Mac Studio, because no one is cross-shopping a Mac Studio and this stupid thing. It's just physically space alone. Like, it's not like, well, I could have this little thing that sits on my desk that looks like this, you know, a tall Mac Mini, or I could have something the size of a truck that I don't even know where the hell I'm going to put it. They're not cross. It's just too, it's huge. It's gigantic. And what you'd have to be saying, okay, it's gigantic, but in exchange for that gigantic thing, I get what? And if it's just like a Mac Studio inside there, it's like, I don't, you know, that's a product that nobody wants. That's what Jason's talking about. I don't understand it, right? So if the Mac Pro is in this case, they either have to keep making that Mac Studio, or they have to bring back the iMac Pro, because there is that hole in the lineup and the Mac Studio now fills it. The Mac Studio and the Apple Studio Display is the deconstructed iMac, you know, the high-end big screen iMac. If they don't want to make that, they can bring back a big screen iMac. But they can't go Mac Mini, nothing in the lineup, thing the size of a truck. It's just, that's too much of a gap, right? That doesn't mean the Mac Studio is going to get updated constantly. If the Mac Studio skips a couple generations, that is, you know, it's more appropriate, because the Mac Pro skips like seven generations. It's like the whole rest of the Mac line comes and goes like in one of those time lapses where you see seasons pass and the Mac Pro is just sitting there unchanged, right? That, you know, and so the Mac Studio will be like that, but with fewer seasons passing in the montage. And I think that is, even though I'm disappointed by it, I think it is not surprising and probably an appropriate use of Apple's resources. And this is the kind of thing with Apple. They're so secretive. They never tell us what's happening, blah, blah, blah. It was nice that they told us they're fixing the Mac Pro, so let people hold on and not, you know, not spend all those years screaming. We just spent those years waiting, right? But at least we knew it was happening. If they had a cadence and told us the cadence, like, you know, they could spin it however they want. The Mac Studio, since it's a high-end machine and blah, 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 will be updated every 2 years. Just tell us that ahead of time so we're not wondering if they're canceling the Mac Studio, or are they going to make an M3 one, blah, blah, blah. Just let us know. Like, if you just tell us the cadence, you should expect a new Mac Pro every 5 years. Just let us know. Don't like make a Mac Pro and then have us saying, are they ever going to make another one? We don't know. Like, because they never want to tell us. And they, especially with the high-end desktop Macs, they haven't had long enough to establish any kind of pattern, because they're too erratic. It's perpetually in crisis. So it's not like they can say, well, we won't tell you the pattern because we can't promise that far in advance, but you can surmise it by looking. No, we can't. It's chaos. Like, we have no idea what's going on over there. The Mac Studio came out of nowhere. Why is there no big iMac? Where the hell is the Mac Pro? We don't know. So you have to tell us, especially for high end. People want to know, should we buy, you know, we love the Mac Studio. It's perfect for our environment. The Mac Mini is a little bit too slow. We like the extra RAM we could put in the Mac Studio. We want to buy them, you know, and when a new one comes out, we want to refresh our whole studio with them. Apple, tell us when you're going to come out with them. Okay, we're going to come out with them every other year. So it's going to be M1, M3, M5, you know, like, just tell us and that would be fine. But Apple does not and probably cannot make those kind of promises that far in advance. So we're kind of left wondering, and that's why you get stories like this one where Gurman's like, you know what? I think the Mac Studio, just like, they're not going to update it anymore. It's going to be a really long time. It makes people afraid for, like, oh, it's my favorite computer. I love a Mac Studio. I hope they make another one. It's like the mini iPhone. They don't tell us, and people have various fears, and sometimes those fears are founded. But in this case, you know, a little bit, something from Apple would help. Either put out the M3 one, and then there'll be some relief, or tell us that, I mean, I don't know how they say this. Vocalize the idea that high-end computers that don't sell a lot get updated less frequency. We all kind of know that in the abstract, But without any communication, it makes everybody who buys those computers fear that as soon as they buy one, like the thing they just bought is now an evolutionary dead end and they're not going to be any more of them. And that's never a good feeling.
No argument here. You're just ready to buy a new computer, aren't you?
I don't know. I mean, if they put an M2 Ultra in a case the size of my thing, I'm going to be like, especially if there's no third-party GPU support, like, why would I buy that? I would start looking at studios and minis, and then I would look back at my computer and I'd say, I'll just keep you for 10 years. We'll see how it happens. Once the latest macOS doesn't run on Intel, it's really going to put the pressure on me.
Yeah, that's going to be the end of it, because like you won't be able to just like hack a driver here or there and make it work. Like that's going to be a pretty hard stop, I think. So
I mean, what'll actually happen is, all right, so that'll be a problem for me because I do have my dinky little apps and I do need to be able to build them and run the latest OS, and I'll probably want to do that, and then I'll start using other people's computers in the family, which will all be ARM. They already all are ARM. I'll use my wife's Mac Studio. I'll use one of my kids' ARM laptops, and they'll be like, hey, get off my computer. You've been using Xcode on my computer. Like, and that's what's going to force me to do it. Not the fact that I can't run the latest OS on my Intel one, but the fact that I'm hogging other people's ARM-based computers and they don't like it.
And if only there was some other ARM-based Mac you could get that was not just the absolute top of the line one.
If they fixed the fans in the Mac Studio, it'd be a lot more attractive to me, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny, like, the fan thing is odd, and I wonder if, if you think back to, like, what I was saying earlier, like, why the Mac Studio exists, was it always intended to be, like, a temporary, holding spot in the lineup waiting for the Big Mac Pro, was it intended to always be there and to have the Mac Pro go, substantially above it? I wonder if it was maybe designed in a rush?
Maybe the Mac Pro was not
hitting their schedule that they originally planned, and so they kind of made this like as a rush job, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it has like such weird engineering in certain ways, like the fans.
So thinking back to what we talked about before and about the Apple TV 4K and watching the old versus the new, if you've seen the inside of the Mac Studio, that does not look like a rush job. Mm. Like that is so, it is much more towards the over-engineered, custom, beautiful on the inside design. That is not a rush, right? Combined with the fact that the quote-unquote half-size Mac Pro rumors have been around forever. Now, was that referring to the Mac Studio? We don't know, because these rumors are so old. But like, remember, like, I guess as soon as the 2019 one came out and the ARM transition happened, the rumor was, hey, the next Mac Pro they're going to have two Mac Pros. One's going to be a half-size one and one's going to be full-size. And it has never been clear to me whether the Mac Studio is the half-size one or the half-size rumor is totally false or they really had a half-size one. But when I look at the Mac Studio, if it was the half-size one, that rumor is super old, and that means the product wasn't rushed. And then I look at the inside of it, and I'm like, this does not look like a rush job. This looks like a computer that somebody sweated over every detail. Like, it's too good-looking on the inside, and it's too perfect. And the fact that the cooler has, low-diameter fans that spin too fast and make a weird droning noise just seems like a design miss. Like, I think they made the computer they wanted to make, and they just didn't think about the idea that all their other computers are so damn silent that now this is the noisy one. Again, it's dead silent when it's bolted under my desk, but it's noisy enough and annoying enough. Like it's not just the volume. If you put like a decibel meter by it, it's the nature of the sound, the frequency of the sound. It is annoying enough that people don't want it on their desk. And so it got banished and banished under the desk. It's, totally silent and fine, which is why I would consider getting one. But I think it's a miss when all your other computers either have no fan or are dead silent, including the Mac Mini, which you think would be a more thermally challenging situation, especially when it's got the same processor, like the M1 Max Mac Mini, which we now have, compared to the M1 Max Mac Studio. From all the reviews I've seen, because I haven't seen an M1 Max Mac Mini, but from all the reviews, the M1 Max Mac Mini is quiet. It's practically silent. And the Mac Studio, it got that same drone that they all have, which is just... I think it's just a design miss. So I feel like, that's not, I mean, maybe the cooler was rushed, but like everything else about it, the motherboard, the case, everything about it looks just not as over-engineered as Apple TV, but pretty close if you've looked at a teardown.
Hmm. Let's do some Ask ATP. Scott Wright writes, hey, Marco, do people like me who remain subscribed to podcasts no longer release new episodes like Just the Tip and Hello Internet? Does that create much overhead for your feed crawlers? My guess is no, but I'm always surprised when I get glimpses of your data models, so I wonder.
So the way Overcast currently syncs things, and this has actually changed over time, it used to be And I think, I forget whether the watch still is this way. It might be. It used to be that the Overcast app would only sync information to, like, from the servers about episodes that were not yet deleted. So if you had a podcast that you'd, like, listened all the way through to, and you went to its screen and there were no episodes in the unplayed or now current tab, if you tapped over to the all tab, it would have to do a network fetch to populate the all list because that was not stored on your device. A while ago, I changed that so that now any podcast that you have in your subscriptions at all, the app always downloads all information about all episodes about it. And that enables things like search on the app. That's I believe the reason I made that change. So it no longer only gets the current ones and now gets all. So on some level, the app you're syncing data about all of those old dead feeds to my servers all the time. But that being said, my server, the protocol is a little bit efficient, and I'm actually working on making it more efficient. I talked about it a little bit in Under the Radar this week, but the current protocol, it won't sync data. It won't even check before first checking basically a change version number. And if the feed is not really changing on a regular basis, it's not going to be downloading much of anything or loading much of anything. So it's not much of a load. But the number of feeds that you have in Overcast is the important factor there, and how often they change their data, like on their end in their feed. Like the heaviest feeds for Overcast to deal with are Patreon feeds. Because Patreon feeds, there's a lot of them, because if you subscribe to a Patreon member podcast, every user gets a individual feed, just like the ATP member feeds. Every user gets individual feeds, and everything is like hashed to that user. The problem with Patreon feeds is that they also have these giant long hashes that are like built into different content areas of the feed that change over time. They're like expiring signatures for S3 or whatever else. And so Patreon feeds are huge, and they change constantly. They also tend, I believe they tend to have the full text of all their posts in their feeds as well. So if you have a podcast like John Roderick's Patreon, where there's like these giant like walls of text as like essays that were also posted as the show notes, that's being downloaded every single time anything in that feed changes, and Patreon changes their feeds constantly because they have these expiring URLs. So there are feeds like that that are pretty heavy loads on my server just because they, on their end, are changing those constantly. And there's a huge volume of them. Like, I have to have special handling in my crawlers to kind of back off a little bit on Patreon feeds and to not save every revision they make. Like, if I sense that they've only changed the signatures on the URLs, I actually will delay and not save every one of those. I'll only save it like once a day or something like that. I forget what it's currently set to, because I have no idea how long those URLs last. I haven't tested like how long they take before they expire, but it's at least a day. So anyway, and if anybody out there works at Patreon and works on their feeds, please get in touch. I would love to talk about this and maybe, save us both a ton of bandwidth at some point. Because this is hurting them even more than it's hurting me, because they have to serve these to everybody. For the most part, having a feed in Overcast that is subscribed at all, like that is in your list, whether you have the little follow every episode or not, if it's in your app, if it's listed in your list, having that has a small amount of overhead to Overcast. But it doesn't matter what the status of your episodes within it is. It doesn't matter how many you have unplayed or how many you have marked as played or deleted or whatever. That none of that matters. It just matters how many episodes are in the feed, because that's being stored as database rows on both sides. And then it matters how much that feed changes. And for these old shows that are not having these time-bombed URLs, those feeds pretty much never change. So it's fine.
Yeah, Scott's question was specifically about how much overhead does it create for your feed crawlers. And the whole reason you have feed crawlers is so you don't have to have, it's not like every individual user is doing the same job. Your feed crawlers to run on your server, you can crawl that feed once, and everybody who subscribes that for non-changing normal feeds, like regular podcasts, like it doesn't matter if 1,000 people subscribe to it or one person subscribes to it, your feed crawler crawls it, and it doesn't have to crawl it n times for n number of people. So Hello Internet, for example, regular feed, nothing weird going on with it, hasn't released new episodes in a long time. It doesn't really matter how many people have this. If Scott keeps Hello Internet in his subscription list or doesn't keep it, your feed crawler is crawling the Hello Internet feed more or less the same amount of time. I'm sure you have adjustments for like when it becomes more popular or whatever. Yes. And back off on it. But it's like, what I'm saying to Scott is don't worry, you're not hurting Marco's feed crawler by keeping Hello Internet in your thing. It's fine. His feed crawler is crawling it the amount of times appropriate for a feed that has not updated in years, and you staying subscribed to it isn't changing that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's funny, like, you know, it's kind of like computer science. Like, there's only three numbers, like 0, 1, and N. Or some people are even just 0 and N, depending on what version of this you've heard. But that's kind of how my feed throttling works. It's like, if I have a feed that has no subscribers and is not listed in Apple Podcasts, Overcast will automatically delete it after a while. If it has no subscribers but is listed in Apple Podcasts, I don't think it'll ever automatically get deleted, but I will crawl a 0 subscriber feed much less often than a feed that has any subscribers at all. And then there's also a big difference between one subscriber and anything more than one. Because, again, that's all those Patreon feeds, like, you know, or any kind of membership, you know, the ATP membership feeds. Almost all of those are going to have at most one person in Overcast who has those feeds in their account. So I'm going to crawl those at a different interval as well. And there's certain ones where I've worked with the hosts to say, like, certain hosts of, you know, membership stuff, like I think Memberful, I might special case them. I special case the Stratechery Empire of Stratechery, Stratechery Plus, and Ditherings. I work with Ben Thompson on, like, you know, what kind of rate do you want me to crawl you, and is this too much or is this too little? So I have a few special cases in there, but for the most part, I just crawl based on frequency, based on popularity. And so, you know, if you have no subscribers, or one subscriber, or a lot of subscribers, that matters. But no other distinction really does.
Do you have particular special cases for ATP membership? Because I know we're gonna get asked.
I gotta check. I actually think I don't, because so the other thing is I have a thing in place. I have a ping API where hosts, if they want to, in their CMS, can send a ping request to Overcast that says crawl these feeds with this prefix as soon as you can, like now or whatever. And a few hosts have done this, and I've actually run into issues because Overcast is too fast. That a lot of times they will put this in some part in, like, you know, the kind of, like, you know, the after save method of their CMS or whatever the equivalent there is. But a lot of times their own CDN hasn't updated the feed contents yet at that point. And so Overcast will say, all right, I'll crawl it right now. And it goes and crawls it right now and gets old data. But because I have the ping API on ATP and I implement caching correctly, it's funny. I think I artificially delay the ping crawls now by a few seconds just to try to avoid that problem. But anyway, because I developed the CMS, I implemented ping support. So I don't think I have special case handling for our crawl intervals, because whenever we publish a new episode, the CMS just sends a request to Overcast, hey, ping these feeds. And over the following few minutes, Overcast pings them all and reverses them all. So if you're telling me when your feed is being updated, I don't have to be pulling it as frequently. So I don't think I have any special case handling for us.
Fair enough. John Susek writes, would a MacBook with 8 64 gig NAND chips read data about 8 times faster than a single 512 gig chip? Would that drive be about 8 times less reliable? Is this conceptually something like RAID 0 at the chipset level? John, I feel like you should probably handle this.
Yeah, I think this is a good question for people who haven't looked into, like, hardware stuff that often, because of the story we talked about, you know, a few times now with Apple putting, you know, one SSD chip that has all the storage versus two chips of half the size, and the two chips of half the size get you twice the speed. And so it's an obvious question if you haven't, you know, looked into this, is like, well, does that just work? Does that scale linearly? Can I just keep chopping up my SSD into smaller and smaller pieces and get twice the speed, four times the speed? Obviously, you know, if you think about it for a second, it's like, well, if that worked, someone would be doing it, right? And in some respects, that is true. If you parallelize access, you can get more bandwidth and everything. But the dollar sign comes in here. You can make bus widths wider and wider. And as you do that, especially with high speed-ish things like memory, or, you know, SSDs are not as fast as memory, obviously, but, like, still faster than hard drives, it gets real expensive real fast. Especially when you're talking about something that interfaces into the CPU, or, you know, into an SoC, or into some large part of the system that lots of things have access to, wider and wider buses are more expensive. It's part of the reason that the, you know, the VRAM that they put on high-end GPUs, you know, it's like, why does it cost so much money to have 16 gigs of VRAM? 16 gigs of RAM costs nothing. Well, the VRAM on a high-end GPU has a hugely wide interface to the, you know, to the GPU itself on the thing. First of all, it's physically close to it, which means the signals don't have to travel far. And like, I forget the bus widths, but I think they're like over 512. I don't like they're really, really wide. Back in the day, you know, in my youth with memory interfaces, it was like everything was like sipping through a straw, right? It was just these tiny narrow interfaces. When they got a little bit wider, we'd get really excited. But money has always been the limiting factor. So for like a laptop, for example, you know, if you made the bus eight times wider, well, at that point you'd be like, okay, but the SoC can't even handle that. Like the SoC itself does not have enough. You know, the bus width going to the SoC for this data is not wide enough. So it doesn't matter how big you make it. Like there's no more bridge chips anymore, but it doesn't matter how wide you make it. Eventually it's got to funnel into what the SoC can handle. Right. And I feel like probably on the ones where they have two or four chips, they're probably maxing out the number of the width of the, you know, IO system that reads SSDs on those SSCs, and adding more of them, you would get nothing for it because you're already using up all the lines. Back in the, you know, PCI Express days and the various bridges, we talk about, you know, the PCI Express lanes and everything, or the Thunderbolt, we talk about the bus width, but it's the same thing with names that I just don't know for the SoC and the SSD interface. So yeah, the answer is you can make it wider, but it'll cost way more money. It'll take more power. It'll produce more heat. And so I think, and someone from Apple can correct, or someone who knows better can correct me if I'm wrong, I think the fastest SSDs in Apple's laptops are using all of the available bandwidth to those SoCs, and you're not going to get any more speed by doubling the number of chips or whatever. And the ones that are half, quote unquote, half speed are using half the width because they just have one chip and the other one would use the rest of them. In terms of reliability, yeah, I mean, making two chips don't fail twice as often as one chip usually, because it really depends on how you're pushing the envelope. It's kind of like, should I get the one biggest hard drive I can get or two smaller ones? What does that do for reliability? If they just came out with, like, you know, I don't know what size hard drives are. If they just came out with a new 28 terabyte hard drive and it's the only one in the market and it's cutting edge, maybe, you know, don't go with that one. Go with two 14 terabyte ones, right? But if it's a common size that's been around for a long time, having, you know, two 256s and a single 512, I imagine the reliability of all those things is pretty good. Your main factor is going to be wear leveling and wearing out the NAND and all that other stuff that is more of a factor than somehow the chip going bad or whatever. So, it's a good question, but I think the answer is no, Apple is not. Computer manufacturers in general are not being silly by not having tons of little SSD chips. They're more or less doing everything they can to get the most performance at a reasonable cost and power budget for their given computer.
Bartosical writes, how do you handle unknown callers? I'm in a situation now where I get a lot of calls and I just do not have the time to take unknown calls. In Sweden, we have websites that are quite good at resolving who the caller was, but it takes a few taps and holds a copy of the phone number from recent lists. And sometimes I fail and the phone calls the number instead. What do you guys do? I don't have this happen very often. So for me, I typically just ignore them and let them roll to voicemail. And I'd say about 8 times out of 10, I end up deleting the voicemail that they leave about my car's warranty running out. But that's just me. Marco, I feel like you've done a lot of, or in the past, you had done a lot of research on like anti-spam apps and things of that nature.
Call blockers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So what is the current state of the world for you?
So, you know, it's different because, you know, everybody has different needs about, you know, what is your risk tolerance for inadvertently missing a valuable call, like, or a call that you actually might want. So everyone has to set this differently. You know, some people, like, you know, if they give their phone number out as part of their job and, you know, they might have strangers calling them all the time and that's like, you know, new customers for them, they have to be pretty careful what they block, you know. If you want to go fully nuclear, the nuclear option, which I have done, I don't currently do it, but I did it for a while, is a few years ago, Apple added an option called Silence Unknown Callers. And this is just a setting somewhere. I think it's in the phone app or in the phone app settings in the settings app. It's somewhere in the settings app. And Silence Unknown Callers does exactly what it says. Any caller that's not in your contacts, it just gets sent to voicemail. And that is the nuclear option, and it does work. It works really, really well if you don't want to be bothered by unknown calls. The downside is you will miss things that you would have wanted because, you know, if somebody's not in your contacts. And it tries to be a little bit smarter, like, you know, if there's like a phone number in one of your recent email messages or a phone number that you've recently dialed, it won't silence those trying to call you. So it's a little smarter than just your contacts, but it's, you know, you will miss a lot if you use that option. But again, I used it for like a year and it was fine. I have a bit of a different situation in that I got my cell phone when I lived somewhere else than I currently live. And I pretty much know, and the good thing is, you know, most U.S. spam callers, not all, but most of them try to call from your local exchange. So it'll have the same, you know, first usually six digits of your phone number, or at least it'll be like from the same area of your phone number, because they are trying to trick you into thinking it's a local call. Well, if you don't live there, you know that is probably spam. Yeah, you know, yeah. So I'll have, you know, random calls like from White Plains. And it's like, well, I know that I have no reason for any strangers in White Plains to be calling me. And so what I do is I send, and if I see a call that's from one of these areas that I know is going to be like, you know, trick spam, trying to trick me into thinking it's a local call, I will send this to voicemail. I'll decline the call. And then sure enough, in the voicemail, I'll have a message that says the exact same thing. It'll be 3 seconds long. It'll say hello, dot, dot, dot in the transcript. And it's the exact, and I'll have, you know, I'll get maybe five of those in a day. But then, and here's the trick, I will block every single one of those numbers because it's just two taps. You know, you hit the info on the missed call record or on the voicemail, you hit block contact. I'll block every one of those numbers. And I did that for a few weeks where every time I would get these, you know, dud things that were sent to voicemail or something I would pick up and it was end up being spam, I would block the contact. And so I ended up having something like, you know, 30, 40 block numbers. But that actually has dramatically reduced the amount of spam calls I've gotten because it turns out, you know, most of these calls are coming from the same, you know, banks of numbers, like the same relatively, you know, countable, knowable sets of, you know, spammable numbers. So that actually had a huge reduction. But that is again, that's kind of a trick that I know. And I even found a call blocker app. Like there's an area in Westchester where I've never done any kind of business with anybody, and I was getting tons of spam calls from their numbers. And so I just blocked the entire town. Like I downloaded I forget what it is. There's like some kind of like simple call blocker app where you can just block ranges of numbers. So I just blocked like, you know, the first six digits and then anything in the last four. So like those 10,000 numbers, I just blocked them all. And that also had a nice big effect. you know, so that's, but you know, that's one of the luxuries you get if you know that if that like local calling trick doesn't work on you because you don't live in the same area code as that number anymore. So, you know, for me, it's like, you know, if somebody calls from Long Island, I'm going to pick it up, but I've never had a Long Island phone number, so I don't get spam from Long Island. So it's actually kind of nice.
And yeah, there's another fun thing that I assume is uniquely bad in the U.S. because USA, USA. Don't you think there should be laws stopping people from making automated spam calls, pretending to be from places they're not? No, because the spammers who do this lobby our lawmakers and put money into their campaigns.
I think there are laws; they just aren't following them or enforcing them.
Toothless wall laws that allow that have ways to get around them because those people spend a lot of money to it's terrible. Anyway, our system is stupid. That's why we have this stupidity. But given that we have this stupidity, the way I deal with it, so I do like the call blocking apps. I've tried a bunch of them. I never had the guts to try the one that I think Marco tried, but it's just like, hey, actually we'll intercept your calls and your calls won't come to you. Your calls will go to us and then we'll forward them to you. Yeah. What was that one called?
I forget. It was terrible. I undid that within like a week.
Yeah, it's too scary for me.
I've tried a lot of those apps.
I don't want to damage delivery of my phone calls. Are too important for me to allow it to actually go through like a third party location and they get my number and whatever. Anyway, but the call blocking ones that just run on your phone and just have like a list of known spam numbers, I run one of those. They're better than nothing. The one I do is like, it's like $20 a year. I think it's Nomo Robo. Which means Nomorobo, no more robocalls. It catches a bunch of stuff. It catches enough stuff that $20 a year, it makes it worth it for me. It does not catch all of it, not even close, right? So then I'm left with, you know, what gets through. I am also a serial blocker. If I get any call from anybody ever, if it's a voicemail about my car warranty, if it's a voicemail that's in a language that I don't understand, like if it's literally anything, block, 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 block. just block like crazy. And it's frustrating because you're like, oh, I block the same, like, I feel like I should get that app that Marco had. I block the same looking numbers a million times. How many of these do they have? Well, I guess they have 10,000 because that same 6 inches is the same. They're just going to cycle through them to, you know, put this message in Chinese that I don't understand, and they keep sending it to me, right? So that's frustrating, but you do sort of like start to win that war of attrition because there aren't that many numbers, right? I do have one weird factor that factors into this. This is why I don't do the block unknown callers because I you know, it's kind of like ad blocking on my Mac. It's more frustrating for me when a site doesn't work because of an ad blocker than it is for me to deal with the ads. So that's why I'm less inclined to block as aggressively on my Mac as I do on my phone. I don't want to miss calls. You know, if it's just the car dealer calling or someone you have working on the house or the food delivery person, it's frustrating for me when they go to voicemail, especially if I don't know, you know, so I don't do the nuclear option of like block all unknown callers, right? But that means a bunch of stuff does come through. And the reason I can't 100% ignore every single unknown call, which is my inclination, by the way. If a call comes into my phone and I don't recognize the number, I just, you know, tap the power button and, you know, ignore it, right? That is what I do 100% of the time. So I'm basically implementing block unknown callers myself, unless I know that food is being delivered or I know my car is at a dealership. Like, those are the situations. Although I do try to put those people in my contacts so I get a good name for them. But the one weird thing that I have is my telephone number is one digit off from a telephone number in a local hospital.
Oh, no.
Right. And so I get calls on that number and they leave voicemails about like patient X is coming in on Y or whatever.
Oh, God.
And I feel bad about that. And so what I do with those people is I answer, right? Because I can tell, because the caller, because they're not spammers, their caller ID will come up and it will say such and such hospital. Because they're always calling from inside the hospital to another department in the hospital, talking about
inside the hospital.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And so when I see that hospital number, first of all, when it started happening, I'm like, oh my God, something, you know, my wife is dead in a car accident. Right. But eventually I figured this out after maybe a year or two by getting someone on the phone and say, what number did you dial? And it's one digit off. Like, people are just, you know, typoing it. Right. So now when I get those calls,
you're trying to talk to a hospital and you're trying to interview them.
Yeah, right.
Well, but sometimes it's administrative. It's just administrative stuff, because it's like this department saying, hey, this person's coming down or this is coming up or do you have this or whatever. You know, it's like, it's not always like a life or death emergency. But I do feel bad because they leave voicemail and they think they're leaving voicemail at the whatever department. Right. And they're not, like, it's never going to happen. You're never going to connect. It's on my phone. Right. So I pick up every single one of those calls and just say, you've got the wrong number. Right. And they say, oh, sorry. And they, you know, and they don't call back. Right. Because they're legitimate people. Right. I don't even remember what the thing is. I don't interview them anymore to say what number did you dial, because very often they don't know because they just punched a button on one of those like million button phones that's inside a hospital or whatever. So that's why in my special case, I can't actually ignore every single call. If it says the hospital that's near me as the caller ID, I pick it up and I get to talk to a person in the healthcare industry and tell them that they have the wrong number.
They keep you company during the day.
Right.
It's not that frequent. It's surprisingly infrequent because I think people don't type. Like, how often do you type a phone number on like a keypad? Right. But somebody's doing it because they're off by one digit.
Well, these are your coworkers now.
Yeah. Around the water cooler, you ask them like, hey, did you see the latest episode of the TV show last night?
Yeah.
Right. How about that sports team? Yeah. All right. Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace and Mercury Weather. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join at atp.fm/join. We will talk to you next week.
Do we have a post show?
Let me see. I don't think I do.
Go ahead. I was gonna discuss the thing we said we may or may not discuss. We don't have a post show, but if we have one, I'm happy to do that too.
I think that's it. Your thing is it. Go for it.
So the cloud has stopped over the Lisp family, or three quarters of the Lisp family. And this past weekend, we had a bunch of plans, right? We're going to hang out with some friends on Friday at their house. And then on Saturday, we were supposed to have a double date, you know, with a different couple, friends of ours. And we were going to ship the kids off to my parents, which is a very rare treat. And I convinced my parents, which actually didn't take too much convincing, but I had convinced them, hey, why don't you insist on taking the dog too, So this way, Erin and I would be alone. And then this way, I could treat her to a little one night staycation in downtown Richmond. And so I had booked a room for the two of us at some bougie hotel that I've never been to that sounded pretty cool. And you know, we were going to go do dinner.
You're going to go to White Castle.
I got to go to White Castle. I wish. There's none anywhere near me. We had planned
probably
to go to
it.
Yeah, probably. We were going to go to a local Mexican restaurant. Well, I don't know if it's strictly speaking Mexican. It's in that neck of the woods, so to speak. But anyways, we're going to do that. And then we were, you know, stay overnight and live like, you know, childless and carefree and I don't know. I can't think of the turn of phrase I'm looking for. But we're going to do all that. And then, you know, we would go to mom and dad's on Sunday and pick up the kids. And then I don't think we had any particular plans Sunday. And Erin woke up Friday morning. And she had a little bit of a sniffle, and I had gone to lunch with a friend on Friday, midday, and then shortly after the lunch, I had a smidgen of a sniffle, and then at about like 3:30, Erin says to me, "You know, my throat kind of hurt." What?
Oh,
my throat
that's
hurts
not
a little
good.
Bit. So I said, "Does it now?" She's like, "Yeah." So. We look at each other and we both kind of say to each other at the same time, we should probably test, shouldn't we? And we were both like, but I don't want to, because I don't want to scuttle our entire weekend that we have all these plans. And so sure enough, Erin tests and she has COVID. I run upstairs to try to cancel the hotel room that actually ends up was I had booked as non-refundable, but I threw myself at the mercy of the court and was like, look, my wife literally 2 minutes ago just realized she had COVID. I don't think you want me parading around your hotel. You know, is there anything you can do? And as far as I know, they did indeed cancel it. By the time I came back downstairs, Declan had tested positive. Michaela had somehow tested negative, which I'm not entirely clear how. And then I tested positive. And so we avoided it. This was February 10. We had gone on, you know, what we had called our lockdown. I don't know if by many standards, it was not a lockdown, but, you know, for us, it was a lockdown. We had done that on March 13 of 2020. So we had made it a month and 3 days shy of 3 years before we finally got zapped. You would think that this was Disney related, but Disney was like 3 weeks ago. So I don't know how we survived the state of Florida without coming home with a souvenir. And by that, I mean COVID. I don't know how we did it because, again,
or
as you recall, exactly. Or a hurricane that just randomly came through.
Florida is just a very high risk area for lots of problems.
Yeah. It's our Australia or something like that. But anyways,
I think Australia is safer.
Yeah, probably. Certainly the people are better. But anyway, point being, so we survived Disney World. And again, you know, we had masked religiously on the way there and back. Once we were there, it was like, whoa, who cares? And so we survived Disney. We did blow up all of our plans, you know, immediately, and we immediately canceled everything as you should. And as you know, we felt like we needed to, and that was a bummer, but all things being all that said, I would much rather, you know, cancel the plans with friends here even if the hotel room was, you know, non-refundable, then, you know, I'd still rather have that go wrong than Disney World. But that being said, you know, I'm fine. I had a moderate cold. Erin had a fairly severe cold. Declan has been boinging off the walls the entire time. Michaela doesn't seem to be any worse in any way, shape, or form. So, this has been a surprising bit of a nothing burger for us. But you never know, right? And I'll make another call back to your Daily Lex. You know, our mutual friend Lex Friedman had just gotten over COVID, and he had a real rough go of it. And, you know, the Liss family is vaccinated. To the best of my knowledge, Lex was vaccinated as well. You know, the Liss family, I can tell you for fact, is boosted. I wonder, although I think this is a very biologically shaky, but I wonder if the reason Michaela never, and we've tested her a couple times now, has never tested positive and has only a sniffle at worst. I wonder if that's because she got her most recent booster literally like two or three days before we left for Disney. And so that's still maybe coursing through her blood. Again, that's probably biologically shaky, but it's the best theory I've got.
I mean, she got a most recent booster, like, you know, within 3 weeks ago. That's, I think that's a pretty, like, she's at like peak resistance at that point.
So right, right.
That's
exactly.
Actually pretty reasonable of an assumption to make.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, who knows? It doesn't really matter. I don't know where it came from. I don't really know who Patient Zero was. The other theory we have is maybe Michaela brought it home and we were just none the wiser and she already got over it by the time the rest of us started to fall. But it's funny because the only reason we even tested in the first place, well, slightly it was Aaron saying, oh, I have a sore throat, but most of it was just because we didn't want to be turds and like spread this to all our friends if it ended up that it was COVID. And at the time that we tested, none of us felt bad. Like, again, it was a sniffle for everyone at worst. And then just a touch, just the teeniest little kiss of a sore throat for Aaron. Now, it turns out that night she had a terrible night's sleep, like had a real bad sinus headache or something along those lines. The next day she had a real bad cough. You know, I had a bit of a cough for a day or two. I've been stuffy and not stuffy and stuffy and not stuffy. So again, for me, it's like moderate cold, for her severe cold. But it's been not that bad. And hey, you know, yay science, because I'm going to assume that the reason it hasn't been that bad for really any of us is because we are indeed vaccinated. So,
yeah.
I'm very happy for that. And I'm very thankful that, you know, we were able to last damn near 3 years before it happening. We'll probably talk a little bit more about this in Analog the beginning of next month, and I'll probably get into more gory details about the whole thing. But I'm both a little sad that we finally fell, but also in a way, I mean, not that we had been really limiting ourselves in any particular way for the most part, but, you know, we still weren't sure, you know, were we going to have crummy luck like Lex, where he was knocked the F out for like a week from what I could tell? Or was it going to be kind of a nothing burger? And it turns out it's been mostly a nothing burger. And so now, you know, the specter of COVID, I mean, granted, you don't want to get it again. I still don't know if I'm going to have some sort of long COVID symptom, but given that I don't have any particularly bad symptoms right now, I assume not. So I feel like that specter is now fizzling, which, or, you know, that's not a word, is it? But you know what I mean? It's not as strong as it once was. It's kind of fizzled. I think that's the word I'm looking for. And so, hey, COVID brain, right?
Oh God.
But, you know, all kidding aside, you know, I don't want to get it again. Like, I'm not going to be a complete moron and just be like, well, you know, I'm now invincible. But it is nice to know that because of science and because we tried to do what we could to wait as long as we could before, you know, we put ourselves in a position to get it, I like to think, knock on wood, that, you know, hopefully we're just a few days away from being in the clear. So, John, it's your turn, baby. It's only a matter of time.
I think I'll pass. I've listened to Lex's podcast as well, and hearing him, how bad it was for him, and also how I mean, obviously, it hasn't been that long since he had it. It was a couple of weeks now, but like still feeling winded and like that kind of recovery. No, thanks. I don't want any of that.
Yeah,
that entirely. And, you know, and because of the new variants and everything like that, you know, it's not as if getting it like it's like getting chicken pox and you're fine now.
Right.
Nope. And I think COVID, kind of like measles, but not to the same degree, like attacks your immune system so that after you get COVID, like subsequent infections, even with the same strain, can be worse because it messes with your immunities. You know, instead of being like, okay, well, now your body has seen it and you're fine. And I, you know, again, no thanks. Don't want any of that.
Even if
I have mild symptoms, I don't want that thing running around. So, I mean, here's the thing with it. Like in the case of Michaela, maybe Michaela had it and you didn't even notice.
Yeah, very much so.
As far as I know, I have never had COVID, but I can't be sure. I'm not testing every single day. Like,
yep, same.
You know, I haven't felt sick. And when I have felt sick, I have taken COVID tests. Like, I mean, my daughter is having the same thing. Oh, I've got a sore throat. I've got this, I've got that. We've used so many tests. She never has it. Right? We're just like, but we have to use them anyway. We got all the free tests from the post office or whatever. All right. So, you know, it's annoying to every time you get a regular cold or a regular sniffle to test. But that's only the only time I've ever been testing is when I have symptoms and they've all been negative. Maybe I got it and I was asymptomatic. Maybe I got it a year ago. But as far as I know, I haven't had it. And I would like to avoid it because it is so like just random. Like it's not, you know, it's not like Lex is decrepit and aged, right? He's similar age to you. He's fit. He's on his Peloton all the time. He's a young, fit person in good health. And it knocked him on his butt and he's still recovering from it. And Casey's in the same situation and it hasn't been that bad. And you just never know. Right. And, you know, again, I also believe Lex has had all his vaccines, everything like that. And so I prefer not to play that lottery and I will just continue to hope that my luck, and that's all it is luck holds out. I mean, I mask everywhere, but the only place I go is the supermarket, the school, like, I, you know, anytime I go to those places, I am wearing a mask. But you know, come on, like it's just dumb luck. Like my mask is not fitted that well. I'm wearing, you know, KN95 instead of N95s, and I try to get them to seal around my gigantic nose, but it's really difficult. And I try to not be in enclosed places for a long period of time, but it's just, you know, when I had friends over recently, we did that podcast. Everybody tested before they came over, and it's just the courteous thing to do. It's like if you're having a big get together. You know, we didn't mask when we were here. We all came together and had fun or whatever, but it's like, hey, just take a test in the morning. It's, you know, it's better safe than sorry. And that's the most frustrating thing about it now. Now that so few people are masking, fewer and fewer as you get, you know, farther into certain geographic areas, it's so hard to know where it even came from, or if, you know, you want to like say, did I do something? Did I put myself at more risk than I thought I was putting in? Like in Casey's case, you just have no idea. You don't even have any idea. It's not, again, it's not even connectable to your Disney vacation. Like, it's just, this stuff is so contagious that it could have been like, you know, you standing in line at the drugstore for an extra 5 minutes and the person next to you had it, and you were wearing a mask, but it seeped through anyway. And it's just, you never know. But like, you know, we all have our own risk profiles, and we decide to do or not do whatever we want. But these people have had COVID multiple times, and it's like worse in each subsequent time. That is like the type of thing I want to avoid, right? You know, there's no way to entirely avoid getting it unless you never have contact with anybody. And I'm not living that way, but I still prefer not to get it. So, and this is not a contest, and I'm not winning by not getting it, because for all I know, I already had it, but I'm going to continue to try to not get it, as I assume both of you will too, because
yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. No, I 1,000% agree. And, you know, the chat room is pointing out, and to the best of my knowledge, they're correct that, you know, with each subsequent infection, you have more and more and more of a risk for long COVID. And so that's that in and of itself is reason to avoid doing anything particularly stupid or risky. So yeah, I mean, I don't plan to be even dumber than maybe I was or wasn't, who knows, but you know, I don't plan to be even more, I don't know, aggressive, for lack of a better word, but I am glad, because I mean, and maybe this is just a Casey thing, maybe not, but particularly before Michaela could get her vaccination. And if you recall, you know, she just turned 5 a few weeks ago, and up until what, like 6 months ago, it was not possible for an under 5-year-old to get vaccinated. And so for the longest time, you know, we felt like there was nothing we could do, and it was out of our hands. Like there was nothing we could do to get her vaccinated. There was no vaccine to give her. And I lived in this just abject fear of, oh my gosh, what if this virus somehow gets into the family before she has had any modicum of protection, and how terrible that could be. Now, granted, you know, generally speaking, the younger you are, the easier it is for you. And certainly in our family, that seems to be the case for the most part. But what if it entered the house and Michaela had not yet been vaccinated? And what if it just knocked her out? And I lived in this abject fear of it. And so I am relieved to know that it has run through the house, and at least this time, none of us in the grand scheme of things seemed too worse for wear. You know, it seemed like it was mostly just a really crappy cold. Now, who knows if there's a time 2 or 3 or 4, which I would assume that this isn't just going to go away suddenly, that there will probably at some point be a time 2 for each of us, and so on and so forth. You know, hopefully it won't be worse. Hopefully it won't lead to long COVID, but I don't know. It's just, in a way, it's a weird relief that this thing that I cowered in fear over, for better or for worse, it has finally arrived and we seem okay. And I think that's, or at least the way I'm attributing this, whether it's right or not, who really knows? There's no way to tell. But the way I'm attributing this is because we did what we thought we should and could, and we got ourselves as vaccinated as we possibly could. And I stand by that decision. I'm glad I made that decision. I encourage listeners to do that. If you haven't gotten your most recent, you know, booster or what have you, please go ahead and do so, because how can it hurt? How could it hurt? And so, yep, that's the situation around here. But I'm hopeful that in the next few days, I mean, I already feel like, and again, this was just this past Friday, I'm recording on a Wednesday, I feel at this point that I'm at like 90%, and it's been less than a week. So we've been very, very lucky with it. And hopefully by a week's time, you know, whether or not we're testing positive or negative, I'm just saying the way I feel, hopefully after a week, I'll be basically right as rain. And again, this is in stark comparison to Lex. who seemed to be wrecked for 3 or 4 days, lost his taste after like day 4 or 5 for a couple of days. You know, he seemed to have a real bad go of it. And just like you said, John, I believe Lex is a year older than Marco and me, if memory serves, but he exercises constantly and, you know, is of good health, like you had said. It's just, you can have crappy luck. And Lex, unfortunately, had crappy luck. And his team also lost in the Super Bowl, so he's had a double dose of crappy luck. But
he did finally test negative in time for his Super Bowl party, though, because he got like 2 weeks before the week and a half before the Super Bowl, and he was worried that he wasn't going to be able to have a Super Bowl party because he was still testing positive, but he was tested negative a few days before, and then had everybody over. It's kind of disappointing that it doesn't work like chickenpox does, because you're like, oh, this thing I was dreading, and now I finally got it over with. But you haven't really. Like, it has, in fact, put you in a slightly worse situation than you were before for subsequent infections. So it's not like, oh, that's a relief, I got it over with and it was okay. Not really much relief. I mean, it's glad that it wasn't bad, but it's not as if now you don't have to worry about it anymore. In fact, you have to worry about it now ever so slightly more than you did before, because subsequent infections are worse. So it just really sucks. And, you know, presumably there'll be new vaccines for whatever the new variants are. The vaccines are just lagging behind the variants by a substantial amount. When I got the latest vaccine, the variant that protected it against was prominent. So it's great. Thumbs up. But since that vaccine, that variant is gone, and like 5 new ones have come and gone, and the vaccine is not as helpful against those. And so it's almost like you wish there was a new vaccine every month, but that would be a little bit much, and science can't do that. So I'm still holding out hope for, superior vaccine research that can protect against future variants in a more sophisticated way. Fingers crossed.
All right, let's do some titles.
It's funny. I'm actually like, when you said like vaccine once a month, like I'm actually currently right now feeling terrible, because I got my tetanus shot yesterday. I
only need it every 7 years, though.
It's 10 years.
10 years, is it? Yeah, it's a pretty long time.
And it's a combo. It's like, you know, the DTaP, I think. It's a whole bunch of stuff in there. So I got that. And all day I've been like feeling like I have a little bit of a fever, even though I keep measuring and testing and I'm fine.
You got the sore arm, too?
Oh, yeah, of course. So I eventually looked up. I'm like, is fever a side effect of this vaccine? And it turns out, like, yes, that's pretty common and it's fine, you know, or feeling a little bit sick, like, it's fine. And so, like, I'm pretty sure that's it, but like, I'm so paranoid now, like, I keep testing. And
speaking of paranoid and testing, like, so I have all these tests, like, most, a lot of them are free. Every time the government offers free tests, we order them whether we need them or not. And of course, my wife being my wife, bought way too many of them. Like, we're at the point now where we need to use them or they're going to expire. Like, we have so many of them, just like we have so many of everything. But the thing that annoys me is, like, yeah, we have occasion to test when like a kid says they have a symptom or when we feel a sniffle, you know, to test, right? Seems like every time I have occasion to be involved in testing, whether it's me personally or me administering a test to somebody else, I reach into the giant bucket of testing things and it's like different every single time. I'm like, what the hell is this test? Like they all have some different. It's like, how can there be that many different ways to do it? Even when they look like they're the same. Oh, this is a tube one where you put in the swab and squeeze out the thing. They're all subtly different and they have different instructions on a giant piece of paper. It's like, can we just standardize this, please? Like there's too many variations. This should not be this complicated. And they're so, like, there's so many steps and so easy to screw up. The worst ones are the ones where they give you the vial, but they want you to punch out a hole in a piece of cardboard to hold the vial. Have you seen those?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you want me to manufacture a little stand, and the instructions say, peel off the foil on the top, and now you have an open container of liquid, and they're like, punch it through this thing. Like, I don't know how many tests I've ruined by, like, tipping.
No, you gotta poke the hole first. Like,
I'm
with your
just
finger.
Following the instructions, because it's literally the first time I'm ever doing this test, right? With the little holder thingy. Some of them don't have the holder, and you have to know that, like, once you open that thing, you're going to be holding it in your hand, because there's no place to put it the whole time.
See, I actually find the ones with a little cardboard hole for the holder, I think those are the best ones.
Ugh, no. Have you done the various strip ones that have,
well, like,
that
the,
don't
the
even
lollipop
have a little
ones
tube?
Are the easiest, I think, to use. But I've used the like, you know, poke the hole in the box ones. I've used those the most because we got the most of those last summer when we all had COVID. So I've used those the most, and it was fine.
The strip one that I used most recently was like it opens like a book. And there's no tube, right? It opens like a book,
the
and there's a little
ones.
Thing.
Like, you put a
and
stick then you, in, and you end up with a lollipop of results.
And then you lollipop them, and then you have to stick them together.
Oh, I haven't seen that. That's weird.
Yeah, no, they're always different. Like, even if it's like the same brand and the same type of test, it's like, how many drops do you want? How, you know, where do you have to squeeze? What line does the liquid have to go up to? How many, and the variation in how deep they want you to swab and how many times and what they want you to do is just all over the map. So every time I'm there, like, with a giant, looks like an old roadmap, like the instructions, of course, can't be like a little booklet or printed on the box. It has to be a piece of paper that unfolds like a roadmap that you can never get refolded. And it's just acres and acres. And you're like, oh, where are the instructions? It's just such an ordeal. You would think 3 years into this, we would have, you know, down to a science. If this was a television show, it would be like The Last of Us, where they just hold a little thing up to your neck and it goes green or red. Nope, you're going to be there squeezing a little swab into a tiny tube. Make sure you squeeze out all the liquid. Ugh, it's so bad. And then I get paranoid and be like, did I do it right? And so I take out a second test and it's totally different than the first one, just to make sure that I'm, you know, it's not false because I screwed it up. It's false because, you know, anyway, COVID sucks.
In conclusion.
Yeah. COVID sucks.
And confirm. All right, titles. I like Little Toblerone Bar. I really like Tim Cook Hot Spare, but it does ruin the joke a little bit.
Yeah, maybe? I think we did.
Yes, that was a repeat joke from a previous episode. That's why I even said, as we said before.
I missed that. All right, fine. I think
it became the show title.
Son of a bitch. That's not good. I like Looks Like a Big Cheerio.
I like Solid Metal Sandwich because it reminds me of Metal Husband, which is that off-quoted by Merlin thing from the... Monster Factory, where they played Fallout 4 with the Metal Husband. That's a great episode. Anyway, Solid Metal Sandwich.
I'm a big fan of I'll Just Keep You for 10 Years.
I could do that. I think they're better, but I can do
it's
that.
It's Valentine's Week. You know, that sounds...
that is true.
I'll Just Keep You? Did I say you, or was I talking to my computer when I said that?
I think you might have been. Yeah, I think so. I also suggested in, like, Please the Boss, but it's not as good, I don't think. I'm okay with Solid Metal Sandwich. That's fine. I'm good with that. But
I don't have anything against Solid Metal Sandwich. Again, I feel like there's better to be had, but I wouldn't veto it.
Someone suggested Deconstructed iMac. Come on, it was like two episodes ago.
I know, right?
You don't listen to every episode and memorize the titles.
I still think Looks Like a Big Cheerio is my favorite of the ones that we haven't dismissed so far. But
no, I don't like the Cheerio one.
All right. I think I'll Just Keep You for 10 Years is a little long, but I do like the tie-in with Valentine's Day.
I think it's 10 Years or Sandwich. Those are my top two.
Yeah,
I would go with 10 Years personally, but I would be fine with either.
Yeah, I go with 10 Years out of those two.
All right, there you have it.
Sweet, that was easy.
Working on the robot, putting in the title. Okay, there we go. All right. Anything else for live people?
I think that's good.
Actually, before you cut them off, I'm just going to do a little teaser. We need you live people to go away because we have a plan for our next member special. We don't know when we're going to record it. That's what we need to talk about. But we have a plan, and it is not a movie. And I think it's going to be a beautiful disaster. So just chew on that. And we will talk to you next week. And
my teaser is, it's even dumber than a movie. Yeah. I hope that doesn't spoil anything, but I think it is. We all agree it's true.
Totally.
Yes, it is. Can confirm.
All right.
All right. Goodbye, life
people. We'll talk to you next week.